Blackstone Audio presents Henry VIII by Abigail Archer. This book is read by Sarah Nichols. Chapter 1. Rise of a Renaissance Ruler. Henry VIII has come down in history as a bloody tyrant, reckless and headstrong, a man who put his country at risk for his sexual appetite, and in many respects he fit that description. But he was also a warrior, a diplomat who maintained England's balance in a time of rapidly shifting alliances, and a man of exquisite taste, refined manners, and considerable learning and culture. The evidence of his many affairs is plentiful, but also fragmentary, since he was far more reserved than legend would have it. His multiple palaces and lavish lifestyle were deliberately calculated to enhance the prestige of the English monarchy, and few kings have ever gathered around them so many talented and glittering personalities. Henry VIII was a Renaissance ruler, presiding over one of Europe's greatest courts at one of history's most creative times.
When the papal nuncio Francesco Chieregato arrived in London in 1517, he was overwhelmed by the magnificence of the Tudor court.
"The wealth and civilization of the world are here," he wrote, "and those who call the English barbarians appear to me to render themselves such. I here perceive very elegant manners, extreme decorum, and great politeness, and amongst other things there is this invincible king, whose acquirements and qualities are so many and excellent, that I consider him to excel all who ever wore a crown." He wasn't born a prince. Henry VIII came to the throne because his father, Henry VII, seized it on the battlefield, defeating King Richard III at the Battle of Bosworth Field in 1485. Henry VII had only a distant claim to the crown. Born Henry Tudor in 1457, a member of Welsh nobility, he was descended through his mother from the Royal House of Lancaster, whose heraldic symbol was a red rose. The family had been battling for the throne for 30 years with the rival House of York, which used a white rose as its emblem. Henry VII's mother, Margaret Beaufort, ended the Wars of the Roses by arranging a strategic marriage for her son to Elizabeth of York, the daughter of King Edward IV, thus uniting the rival clans. Henry Tudor never knew his father, who died of the plague 3 months before he was born, but his mother was instrumental in his rise to power. Ambitious, strong-willed, and politically astute, she arranged for the boy's uncle to take him to live in Brittany, to keep him safe after King Henry VI was murdered and his son Edward died in battle in 1471. She arranged his betrothal to Elizabeth and forged an alliance with the Yorks. But after the Yorkist Richard III was crowned in 1483, she used the new king's unpopularity to incite an uprising in support of her son, and Henry and his uncle sailed from France to battle Richard and claim the throne. As king, Henry VII shrewdly bolstered his title, promptly marrying Elizabeth and establishing the heraldic Tudor rose, a combination of the white rose of York and the red rose of Lancaster. He built up the royal treasury and made peace with France. He and Elizabeth had 7 children, 3 of whom died at birth or in infancy. Henry named his older son Arthur, evoking the legendary English king, and married him at the age of 15 to Catherine of Aragon, cementing an alliance with her father, Ferdinand II of Spain. After making peace with James IV of Scotland, Henry sent his older daughter Margaret to be the Scottish queen. The king's second son, born on June 28, 1491, and also named Henry, was treated as a sort of royal insurance policy, a spare heir in the unlikely event his older brother Arthur wasn't alive when the king died. Although his grandmother had recorded the births of Arthur and Margaret in great detail in her Bible, she barely mentioned Henry's arrival. A second daughter, Mary, was born 5 years later to similar brief notices. Nonetheless, he was treated like a prince, anointed with oil and wrapped in blue velvet and cloth of gold in his cradle. And just weeks after his christening, the formidable Margaret Beaufort, his paternal grandmother, took custody of the infant. He would learn to fear and love her in equal parts.
Henry spent his early childhood at the Palace of Placentia, now known as Greenwich, on the bank of the Thames, 5 miles from London.
It was set in a large park, and he grew to love it, returning to it repeatedly, even though he could choose among many elegant homes. In infancy, the boy was cared for by four rockers and a wet nurse, Anne Luke. Their close relationship lasted past his weaning. When he ascended the throne, Henry gave Anne Luke an annual pension of £20 in gratitude for her care. Henry was 12 months old when he was given his first title, Warden of the Cinque Ports. By the time he was three, he was Warden of Scottish Marches, a Knight of the Bath, and a Knight of the Garter and Duke of York. At that point, his education began, and he acquired his own household. In the years that followed, he was to see little of either his father, who was preoccupied with keeping his hold on the throne and disposing of enemies both inside and outside the kingdom, or his brother, a sickly boy, 5 years his elder, who also had his own palace and household staff. The great force in Henry's early life, and the country itself, was Margaret Beaufort. She had much greater influence on her son than his mother, Elizabeth, and her household easily matched the king's in splendour. Her appetite for power and wealth was combined with genuine piety. Her beautifully tailored gowns, although adorned with magnificent jewellery, were a habit like black, and her portraits often show her reading devotional books. A woman of intellect and learning, she endowed religious houses and took an interest in theology, religious art, and technology. She was a patron of the then-revolutionary printing industry. Beaufort inspired both awe and fear with her moral and political authority. She used the royal coat of arms and appeared at the king's side at royal events. Beaufort's confessor and closest adviser was John Fisher, Vice-Chancellor of Cambridge University, one of the foremost scholars of the day, and a practitioner of Renaissance classicism, which sought out original Greek and Hebrew biblical texts rather than relying on existing translations. She consulted Fisher when it was time to choose tutors for the royal children, and for Henry he recommended a young, able poet and scholar, John Skelton, a moral and religious purist. Skelton was to teach the boy to be conscious of the artificiality and false values of the court, in contrast to the world outside. Beaufort was not alone in her determination to have the children raised by preeminent scholars. Henry VII had spent his formative years on the continent in the early days of the Renaissance, and he wanted England to shed its image of boorishness and cultural backwardness. So he and the Queen, hoping to establish their offspring as a new English royal dynasty, welcomed their early education by the best minds available. When Henry VII seized the throne, he brought to the royal court a number of new men, councillors whose chief function was to reinforce the king's position. As is often true with strong rulers, Henry was both respected and resented for his firm grasp of power and politics. The heavy taxes needed to support his battles with enemies inside and outside the kingdom incensed the public. Young Henry was only 5, 2 years into Skelton's tutorship, when the men of Cornwall rose in rebellion against Henry VII's taxes and marched to overthrow him. As the rebel army approached, the boy was staying with Margaret Beaufort at her palace at Cold Harbour. Beaufort gathered the Queen and her children and sent them on barges to the safety of the Tower of London. Henry VII easily put down the rebellious Cornishmen, but the danger wasn't past. The unrest over taxes had spread, and similar uprisings throughout England made that summer the most nervous of his reign. It wasn't until late autumn that the realm seemed safe, and the royal households returned to their routines. At the age of 7, Henry's childhood ended. Following the customs of British aristocracy, he was taken from the company of all women, except for his relatives. He said goodbye to Anne Luke and his other caretakers, and from then on he stayed in his father's household. But as the younger son, he rarely appeared in court, and when he did, he never spoke except to answer questions from the king. Nevertheless, the court gave him access to some of the most brilliant men of the age, and they made an impression on him, as occasionally he did on them. He encountered Thomas More, then a young London lawyer, and William Blunt, Baron of Mountjoy, a scholarly young friend of Fisher and Skelton who made a pilgrimage to Paris to meet Desiderius Erasmus, a leader of the humanist movement. The two became friends, and when Erasmus came to England to visit his disciple in 1499, Blunt arranged for him to be honoured at a reception by the royal children. Since Arthur was away starting his training as future king, 8-year-old Henry played host to Erasmus and Moore, who had accompanied the scholar. Chatting confidently, Henry greeted his guests and graciously accepted a Latin tribute that Moore had written for the reception. Erasmus had neglected this courtesy, but wrote one of his own when he returned to Mountjoy's home. Erasmus noted that Henry was fluent in Latin and French, the languages of scholarship and diplomacy, and already knew some Spanish and Italian. Printing with movable type had been invented in 1439, so books were an important part of an aristocratic education.
Chivalric tales served a double purpose in the education of a prince, since they appealed to a young boy's sense of adventure while teaching him how to conduct himself. Like other sons of royalty, Henry was presented with Sir Thomas Malory's La Morte d'Arthur, John Froissart's Chronicles, and similar books glorifying personal combat, battles, the slaughter of armies, and the pillaging of villages and crops, which were seen as justified so long as the cause was pure.
Knights lived by a code of honour as laid out by the noble Lancelot in La Morte d'Arthur, the story of the mythical King Arthur. To take my pleasure, that will I refuse, firstly for dread of God, for the knight who is an adventurer should not be an adulterer nor lecherous, for then he will be neither happy nor fortunate in the wars. Either he will be overcome by a simpler knight than he is himself, or else he will, by mischance and the curse upon him, slay better men than himself. And so whoever resorts to paramours will be unhappy, and everything about them will be unhappy. The lesson was underscored by Lancelot's own dire fate when he broke the code in his affair with the king's wife, Guinevere. The code of honour was seen as doubly important for the sons of Henry VII, who took pains to promote his ostensible descent from the King Arthur of Lore. Young Henry was also tutored in chivalric arts, especially music, and learned to play the organ, lute, and harpsichord. His classmates were noblemen's sons, chosen to cement the allegiance of their families, and they spent time together not just in class, but hunting, on the tennis court, and in the tilt yard, the arena where they practiced swordplay and later jousting with lances on horseback. At the tournaments organised by the king, boys could watch knights in plumes and armour dashing their lances on each other's shields. At the age of 15, Henry's brother Arthur was married to 16-year-old Catherine of Aragon, daughter of King Ferdinand II and Isabella I of Spain. The marriage, the outcome of which would loom large in the fate of England, had been arranged when Catherine was 3. Named for her English great-grandmother, Catherine of Lancaster, the bride was a distant relative of Arthur's. In fact, Catherine arguably had a better claim to the English throne than her soon-to-be father-in-law, Henry VII. Her parents were consequential in their own right, not only as the rulers of Spain, but also because in 1492 they had sponsored Italian explorer Christopher Columbus in his attempt to reach the Indies by sailing west across the Atlantic Ocean. The wealth his expedition and its followers were to bring back to Spain would underpin its empire and nourish a great rivalry with Britain. Catherine had a regal bearing, a fair complexion, grey eyes, and long auburn hair. In her youth, she was described as the most beautiful creature in the world, and her mind was world-class as well. Her education included religion, law, and classical literature. Although she didn't speak English, she was fluent in Latin and spoke tolerable French and Greek. Arthur married Catherine in November 1501 in St. Paul's Cathedral, just 10 days after their introduction. He wrote to Ferdinand and Isabella that he would be a good husband to their daughter and told his parents that he thought his bride lovely. Henry VII collected the first instalment of a substantial dowry from the Spanish court. Catherine had spent most of her life segregated from boys and men. She and her sister shared their mother's bedchamber, and the strictly enforced protection of women she had known in Spain was at odds with what she discovered in England, where women travelled the streets of London, worked in shops, and drank in public houses. Catherine had sailed for England in September, and when Henry VII received word that the Spanish galleys had landed, the king, impatient to meet his daughter-in-law-to-be, rode to meet the wedding party at a country house in Hampshire outside London. At first, the Spanish refused to let him see Catherine. Incensed, Henry briefly consulted his counsellors before informing her guardians that he would meet her, even if he had to enter her bedchamber. The Spanish relented, and Henry VII, dressed in riding clothes and covered with dust from the road, met Catherine and exchanged pleasantries with her in Latin. When Catherine rode into London a few days later, the king ordered 400 horsemen to accompany her. 2 days before the wedding, Catherine was paraded through the city. The people of London greeted her enthusiastically. Thomas More was smitten. "Take my word for it," he wrote of Catherine. "She thrilled the hearts of everyone. She possesses all those qualities that make for beauty in a very charming young girl. Everywhere she receives the highest of praises, but even that is most inadequate. I do hope that this highly publicized union will prove a happy omen for England." The nuptials were extravagant. Though the day was chilly, thousands of eager Londoners lined the streets to glimpse their new princess as the wedding parade wound through the streets, passing a series of elaborate allegorical tableaux to St. Paul's Cathedral. 10-year-old Prince Henry met the bride at the western door and escorted her the length of the cathedral to the high altar. The wedding mass went on for hours. As it ended, young Henry leapt onto the raised walkway, took Catherine by the hand, and guided her from the cathedral as the crowd cheered, bells rang, and fountains gushed wine. Since Arthur was nominally the Prince of Wales, the newlyweds set up housekeeping in Ludlow Castle on the Welsh border. Though the castle itself was on high ground, it was set in marshes and not an ideal home for Arthur. The winter of 1502 was harsh, and dank winds blew in the valleys. Within months of the wedding, both Arthur and Catherine came down with the strange and often deadly affliction known at the time as the sweating sickness. Arthur died. Catherine survived. Arthur's death devastated his father. The king stayed away from court, received no visitors, and did his best to support Elizabeth in her grief. He was most concerned over the succession, but she assured him they were both young enough to have more children. They had a daughter the following February, but both the queen and the child died within days. The king's personality changed. Henry VII had relished being monarch. He presided over a splendid court of talented artists and scholars, thought nothing of risking his life in battle, and rejoiced in lavish public spectacles. But after Arthur's death, he lurked in his chamber, a secretive tyrant who suspected everyone of plotting against him. Chapter 2. The Accidental Heir. The king was preoccupied with the succession and anxious to protect 11-year-old Henry from enemies who could endanger the Tudor dynasty. Young Henry exchanged the Dukedom of York for the more prestigious Cornwall, but it wasn't until the next year that he was made Prince of Wales, which is still the formal title of the royal heir. Henry VII also wrestled with the larger consideration of what to do with Catherine of Aragon and the Spanish alliance. The question of whether he might be forced to return her dowry, only a portion of which had been paid, remained unanswered. For a time, the king considered marrying Catherine himself and requested and received papal permission to do so. But he decided instead to betroth her to Prince Henry. 3 years later, however, when Henry was 14, he announced that he had no intention of marrying his older brother's widow, who was 5 years his senior. Catherine's fate remained uncertain, and she was eventually sent to live at Durham House in London. But while her home was comfortable, Catherine's circumstances were dire. She was essentially bankrupt and under what amounted to house arrest. She was often ill and rarely allowed to see Prince Henry, who, despite his determination not to marry her, was still her fiancé. But Catherine was both ingenious and ambitious. In a letter to her father, she complained of her treatment by the Tudors, while insisting she would find her way to a better situation. "I choose what I believe," she wrote, "and say nothing, for I am not as simple as I may seem." Indeed, she was not. In the spring of 1507, the Spanish ambassador to England fell ill. In the course of selecting his replacement, Ferdinand II wrote to his daughter, asking her advice. She told her father to choose an ambassador who would argue for Spain's interests, even if it meant speaking forcefully to Henry VII. She added that whoever Ferdinand dispatched, he would be shocked to learn how she was being treated. Ferdinand, concerned about his daughter's situation, took the ingenious and radical step of appointing Catherine as Spain's interim ambassador to England, the first time in the history of Europe that a woman would hold such a position. No longer a prisoner, she began work as a diplomat, a post she would hold for a year. Catherine quickly worked to improve her English, learned the subtleties of negotiation, and became proficient at writing coded diplomatic reports. Henry VII, at first pleased with her appointment, in the belief that she would prove weak and easy to manipulate, soon learned that she was to be taken seriously. The king complained that she often spoke too cleverly for his taste. For a time, Catherine was happier. Her health improved. She amused herself by attending jousting tournaments where she could observe Prince Henry in competition. Henry was now taller than his father, powerfully built, and considered among the handsomest men in England. He was a superb horseman and fearless jouster. The prince talked incessantly about fighting, jousting, and making war. To Catherine, her betrothed had become quite appealing. But the waiting was difficult. Prince Henry was 16, Catherine 21. Catherine's conversations with Henry VII often turned to her engagement. It was difficult to determine who was more insistent on delaying the wedding, the prince who didn't want to marry her, Ferdinand II who was withholding the final payment of Catherine's dowry, or Henry VII who demanded that he receive the money before the wedding. By 1509 the payment still had not arrived, and Catherine feared the engagement was off. Despondent, she wrote her father that her situation had become so unbearable that she was afraid she might take her own life. She begged Ferdinand to bring her back to Spain so she could join a convent. In the spring of 1509, weeks before Prince Henry's 18th birthday, and shortly after Catherine's dowry had at last arrived from Spain, Henry VII died at Richmond Palace, a royal residence on the Thames upstream from Westminster. Although the king's health had been in decline for several years, his demise came as a surprise. He was little mourned. Quickly forgetting the strong, dedicated monarch who had made England respected and wealthy, people remembered only the obsessive, reclusive tyrant of the previous several years. Nonetheless, his burial in St. Paul's was lavish. The black funeral chariot was attended by 700 torchbearers and 1,400 formal mourners, led by Prince Henry. The king was laid to rest beside his queen, in the Westminster Abbey chapel that bears his name. In the wake of his father's death, Henry VIII reversed himself and agreed to marry Catherine as his father had urged him on his deathbed. He was already thinking like a king. He needed a queen, and Catherine would assure a continued alliance with Spain. His father's instructions had also included defending the church. Interpreting that liberally, Henry dreamed of invading France and reasoned that it would be helpful to have the support of Spain in that cause. Ferdinand II encouraged Henry to marry his daughter immediately. At 23, Catherine was well beyond a marriageable age, and Ferdinand knew that she welcomed the match. If Henry and Catherine were not in love, they were nevertheless well matched for their times and circumstances. Henry and Catherine were married in a small ceremony in Greenwich on June 11, 1509, with William Warham, the Archbishop of Canterbury, presiding. Warham, a pragmatic man, had to set aside his earlier reservations about the propriety of Henry marrying his brother's widow. Before he became Archbishop, Warham, also an Oxford-educated lawyer, had served as a diplomat for Henry VII and had arranged Catherine's marriage to Arthur. Like many in the Tudor court, Warham would struggle with conflicting loyalties, but on this day he supported Henry and Catherine, whose vows, according to Tudor historian Alison Weir, included the promise to be bonair and buxom, gentle and compliant, in bed and at board. 2 weeks later, the couple celebrated their coronation in Westminster Abbey. Following tradition, they spent the previous night in the Tower of London. By now the tower had been displaced as the principal royal residence and was in disrepair, damp and malodorous, with a moat that had become a garbage dump. But Henry had ordered the royal quarters renovated for the occasion. The people of London rejoiced on Coronation Day as the royal procession wound through the narrow streets of the walled city, with its skyline formed by the spires of 80 churches. Henry, carried by barons in a canopied litter, was attired in a cloth of gold doublet studded with jewels, and a crimson velvet robe trimmed in ermine, with a baldric of rubies slung across his shoulders. Catherine, wearing white satin and ermine, followed in a litter hung with white silk and golden ribbons. Her ladies in blue velvet rode behind her on white palfreys. Henry and Catherine made a splendid royal couple. As Thomas More described the monarch, "Among a thousand noble companions, the king stands out tallest, and his strength fits his body. There is fiery power in his eyes, beauty in his face, and the colour of twin roses on his cheeks." Catherine, in the full bloom of her beauty, matched and quite possibly exceeded the king in intellect. Erasmus called her a better scholar than Henry, "miraculously learned for a woman," and "a brilliant example of her sex." Years of adversity had taught her patience and discretion. She always smiled, but beneath her graciousness was a tenacious and resolute will. Deeply pious, Catherine spent hours at her daily prayers and fasted so strictly and often that the Spanish ambassador speculated that it may have hindered her ability to have children. Because the king was not quite 18 years old, his grandmother, the frail but still formidable Margaret Beaufort, acted as regent for the first weeks of his reign. As rich and powerful as ever, she combined a love of books and learning with shrewd political instincts. Now also an ascetic, she wore a hair shirt, or cilice, beneath her black gowns. But her regency seems to have been welcome, coinciding with a period of bliss for the royal couple. Catherine described their early married life as "continual feasting." As the historian Albert Frederick Pollard depicted it, "In the winter evenings there were masks and comedies, romps and revels, in which Henry himself and young ladies of the court played parts. In the spring and summer there were archery and tennis. Music was practiced day and night. Henry diverted himself with jousts, birding, hunting, in visiting various parts of his kingdom." Margaret Beaufort's regency ended on June 28, 1509, Henry's 18th birthday. She died the next day. On her deathbed, she urged Henry to take the scholarly, pious John Fisher as his mentor. Henry had all the bells of London toll for 6 days to mark Beaufort's passing, and Fisher preached at her funeral in Westminster Abbey. But the king wanted no part of Fisher's hair shirts, self-scourging, and diet of bread and pottage. His mentoring ended with the funeral service. Now 18, Henry set out to rule. One of his first regal orders of business was to resolve the resentments his father had left behind. He made overtures to the House of York in an attempt to put to rest lingering grievances. He ordered the arrest of Richard Empson and Edmund Dudley, two of his father's advisers who had been extorting money from English noblemen accused of petty infractions. In a move that would prefigure many others for which he would soon be famous, Henry charged both men with treason and had them executed. But the young king was not solely preoccupied with state matters. Many inside the royal court thought him more interested in hunting and feasting than in governing. Certainly, he was nothing like his diligent father. Henry particularly disliked paperwork, which he found tedious and painful. The king hated writing letters, but he was a voracious reader, particularly fond of theological tracts. In later life he was prone to headaches, he may have suffered migraines, and could not read for extended periods. Henry considered himself an able debater and enjoyed arguing theological matters. He sometimes amused himself by composing poems and song lyrics. One verse fairly described the young king's priorities. He titled it "Pastime with Good Company." "Pastime with good company I love and shall unto I die. Grudge who list, but none deny. So God be pleased, thus live will I. For my past dance, hunt, song, and dance, my heart is set. All goodly sport for my comfort, who shall me let? Youth must have some dalliance, of good or ill some past dance. Company methinks then best, all faults and fancies to digest. For idleness, is chief mistress of vices all. Then who can say but mirth and play is best of all? Company with honesty is virtue, vices to flee. Company is good and ill, but every man hath his free will. The best ensue, the worst eschew. My mind shall be virtue to use, vice to refuse. Shall I use me? Catherine had no objection to Henry's preference for play over his responsibilities as king. She, too, loved to hunt and adored parties, plays, and dances. So the king and queen were, from the outset, happy. Before long, they were in love, or at least eager to say that they were. Henry wrote Ferdinand II, saying that if he were unmarried and free to choose any woman, he would still choose Catherine. Besides jousting, Henry was good at almost every sport he attempted. His stamina at the hunt, where he wore out horse after horse, was legendary. He excelled at tennis, a game he played with abandon. One visitor to the court, after watching the king play, declared that seeing Henry's shirt clinging to his body was a memorable sight. Nature, the visitor said, could not have done more for him. His personality was less felicitous. According to historian Peter Ackroyd, the Henry who now sat on the throne of England was unpredictable and hard to know, a mercurial, self-centred young man whom almost everyone found intimidating or even unfriendly. Speaking frankly, the Spanish ambassador wrote to King Ferdinand, the prince is not considered to be a genial person, and in later years the French ambassador disclosed that he feared personal violence from the king. Henry could be, by turns, generous and accommodating, or willful and overbearing. As Ackroyd puts it, he had the disposition of a king. Not surprisingly, at 18, he lacked judgment and maturity and had never been given the training for governing that his brother Arthur received. Throughout his life, Henry remained headstrong, clinging stubbornly to his notions. As his counsellor, Cardinal Thomas Wolsey, is said to have warned another adviser, be very, very careful what you put into that head, because you will never, ever get it out. A devout Catholic, Henry attended Mass every day.
The Catholic Church in England had been under the control of Rome for almost 1,000 years, since Pope Gregory the Great had sent a team of missionaries headed by a Benedictine monk named Austin to England to convert the Anglo-Saxon pagans in 595 AD. In 597, after successfully converting the local king, Austin was named the first Archbishop of Canterbury, the highest official of the Catholic Church in England.
Henry VIII, like all kings of the time, was believed to have come to the throne by divine right. Consequently, his power was both temporal and allied with God's. Church and state under Henry were bound together in his person, though the king could never be thought to be above the church. In time, Henry would challenge this idea, but in the early days of his reign, he concentrated on reinforcing the secular power of the English monarchy. And Henry had advantages. His subjects liked him, arguably as much or even more than they had disliked his father in his later years. He also was rich. His frugal, acquisitive father left him a great fortune. This enabled Henry VIII to refurbish and spend time in various palaces and to undertake progresses throughout the country, in which he could show himself to his subjects, who saw his lavish lifestyle as evidence of the prosperity and prestige of their country. The stature of the Tudor monarchy soared. The king, once addressed as Your Grace or Your Highness, was now called Your Majesty. Henry VIII was already a landowner with vast holdings, having inherited 7 palaces, including Westminster, the Tower of London, Greenwich, and Windsor, 17 country houses, and 14 medieval castles. Not only did he remodel most of them, he added to the collection by building more. He built and refurbished more royal residences than any British monarch before or since. Earlier kings had been careful to show their piety by financing churches and monastic buildings, but Henry spent no money on religious monuments, aside from finishing chapels at Westminster and King's College, Oxford. He even tried to take over a bequest that Margaret Beaufort had designated for St. John's College, Cambridge. But John Fisher, acting as her executor, battled the king's lawyers and succeeded in keeping most of the money for the college. Henry craved privacy, and as he remodeled his palaces and built new ones, he began to live more apart from the rest of the busy communal court. Now public functions occurred in the great halls, while the king and queen lived in separate apartments. Each palace had rooms and chambers in which to conduct official business. Access to them depended on a visitor's rank. Except for the king's and queen's bedchambers, the most restricted room in the palace was the privy chamber, where the king dined, worked, and spent much of his day. The important rooms in each palace were lavishly decorated with wool and silk tapestries, of which Henry owned more than 2,000. The furniture was finely made, but spare. Most rooms needed space for many people to stand. Like other European sovereigns, Alison Weir writes, Henry was influenced by humanist teachings on sovereignty, which emphasized strong centralized rule, dynastic continuity, and the consolidation of royal power. Of these, highest on Henry's list of priorities was dynastic continuity. The king had to have an heir, and for this he needed his queen. Catherine conceived immediately after marrying Henry, or possibly earlier. The baby arrived fewer than 8 months after their wedding at the end of January 1510. But the child, a girl, was stillborn. On New Year's Day, 1511, Catherine delivered a boy they named Henry. The king ordered a great celebration, but the baby lived only 53 days. The line of succession was off to a troubled start. Still, the king and queen were by all accounts happy with each other, the many years of uncertainty and unhappiness all but forgotten. Catherine's obstetrical problems would persist. She had at least 6 pregnancies, only one of them producing a healthy child, her daughter Mary, who was to rule England briefly in later years. Henry's second wife, Anne Boleyn, also had repeated miscarriages. Although infant mortality was high in the 15th century, this fact has led some researchers to speculate that Henry may have had a rare blood type called Kell positive that caused women he impregnated to develop antibodies that attacked their fetuses, resulting in miscarriage. From the beginning, however, Henry, perhaps because it was a common prerogative of kings, took a succession of mistresses. The first of Henry's lovers may have been Anne Stafford, one of the Queen's ladies-in-waiting, with whom some historians think Henry had an affair that began in the wake of Catherine's stillborn delivery in early 1510. Stafford's story and her entanglement with the royal family were complex matters. Whether she was or was not the king's mistress, the rumours surrounding her illustrate the constant intrigues and rumours that permeated the court. The queen's ladies-in-waiting, so often implicated in these affairs, were not commoners doing domestic work. They were women of noble rank, or the wives of prominent men engaged in government or diplomacy, or sometimes members of the extended royal family. More companions than servants, they assisted the queen in her daily routine. Anne Stafford was the daughter of Henry Stafford, the second Duke of Buckingham. In 1483, when Anne was still an infant, the Duke was executed for leading a rebellion against Richard III. Anne eventually married Walter Herbert, son of the first Earl of Pembroke, but he died shortly after their wedding. She quickly remarried George Hastings, an earl whose grandfather had also been executed by Richard III. Anne would eventually have 8 children with Hastings, and he remained devoted to her to the end of his days. But their marriage had to pass through the tempest that was King Henry's court. Anne's older sister, Elizabeth, was also a lady-in-waiting to the Queen.
As the Spanish ambassador, Don Luis Carroz, reported to King Ferdinand in the only contemporary account of the Stafford intrigue, the two married sisters were in unequal favour in the court.
Queen Catherine was partial to Elizabeth, while the king was fond of Anne. According to Carroz, most agreed that Anne was sleeping with someone other than her husband, but it was unclear whether it was Henry or an aide to the king named William Compton. The popular conjecture was that Compton was allowing people to believe he was involved with Stafford to give cover to Henry, who was her actual lover. In any event, the diplomatic report by Carroz hints at multiple indiscretions and suspicions. According to the ambassador, Elizabeth arranged a meeting with her brother, the Duke of Buckingham, along with her husband and Anne's husband, to uncover what Anne was doing, and with whom. The ambassador declined to speculate, whether Queen Catherine was behind this informal investigation, though he did note in his report that Elizabeth was her favourite. It was decided that the Duke should hide in Anne's apartment to see who might call on her. Presently, William Compton arrived. The Duke, enraged, argued with Compton. Later, the Duke was rumoured to have said something about not allowing his sister to be used by Comptons or Tudors. Whether he actually made such a statement isn't known, but it would have been consistent with palace gossip. Hearing of this confrontation, Henry warned the Duke that he had no standing to upbraid any member of his court. The Duke fled the palace and did not return for days. Meanwhile, George Hastings installed his wife in a convent some 60 miles from London. Henry, discovering that Elizabeth had hatched the spying episode, dismissed her and her husband from the court. Henry apparently believed that Elizabeth had recruited a number of ladies of the court to spy on him and report, by way of Elizabeth, to Queen Catherine. He wanted to banish them all, but decided that would be too great a scandal. The king argued with Catherine over the affair. The storm, as Corroz called the fight between the two, went on for some time. Catherine, the ambassador said, had tried to defend the Duke of Buckingham, a hint, perhaps, of what she believed was happening. The Stafford matter ended without resolution. Eventually, both sisters returned to the court. In 1513, Henry gave Anne a large silver cup, some thought it too large, as a New Year's present. It's possible he gave something to Elizabeth as well. Both women gave presents to the king. For his part, William Compton swore to the end of his life that he had never had an affair with Anne Stafford. But when he died of sweating sickness in 1528, he left a significant portion of his estate to Anne. Chapter 3. The King's Men. Henry brought England's best minds to his court. Foremost among his advisers was Thomas Wolsey. There are varying accounts of Wolsey's background, but no one doubts that he rose from common stock. He was born around 1473 in Ipswich. His father, Robert Wolsey, was said to have been either a butcher or a cloth merchant, believed to have been killed at the Battle of Bosworth Field. Wolsey was bright enough to get an education at a clerical school, and he proved a gifted and disciplined student. After becoming a priest at the age of 25, he was named Dean of Divinity at Oxford and went to work for the Archbishop of Canterbury. In 1507, Wolsey became royal chaplain to Henry VII. Intelligent, driven, and fiercely loyal, Wolsey had a rare talent for doing his job without giving offence to anyone. The king came to depend on his intelligence and work ethic. Wolsey got out of bed as early as 4 o'clock in the morning and could work for 12 straight hours without losing concentration. As his usher, George Cavendish, wrote of one such stretch, "My lord never rose once to piss, nor yet to eat any meat." Wolsey was soon an indispensable counsellor. Like Henry VIII, Wolsey was young and energetic. Unlike the king, he had a keen interest in the minutiae of governing. Although the new king was quite different from his father, Wolsey was equally devoted to his new ruler. But he was also determined to see that the former king's will was done. Early in his reign, Henry VIII appointed Wolsey as his almoner, in charge of charitable enterprises and dispersing money to the poor. More important for both Wolsey and Henry, the almoner was a member of the Privy Council. This posed a problem in Wolsey's personal life. The English clergy did not always adhere to the requirement of celibacy, and Wolsey had two children with his common-law wife, Joan Lark. This relationship became an issue when Wolsey became a member of the king's inner circle. So, he arranged a marriage between Lark and another man. Dating from the first Norman kings, the Privy Council, made up of members of Parliament, diplomats, and army and church officials, consisted of 40 close advisers to the king. By the time of Henry VIII, the council's authority was greater than that of either Parliament or the ordinary courts. The Privy Council advised the king on all matters, had extensive judicial powers, and effectively controlled every aspect of government. With the approval of the Privy Council, the king could enact a law by simple proclamation. When Henry VIII ascended the throne, the Privy Council was dominated by older advisers who had served during his father's reign. Recognising that the brash young Henry did not mesh well with these more conservative men, Wolsey soon contrived to force them out. In 1515, Henry named Wolsey Lord Chancellor, his highest and closest adviser. That same year, Wolsey acquired a monastery on a parcel of land on the Thames in southwest London. He demolished most of the buildings and began construction on an ambitious new palace, Hampton Court, soon to be the largest and most luxurious in England. Wolsey devoted a decade to the initial phase of construction on the massive red brick compound and built more than 40 guest apartments, plus a suite of lodgings for the king and queen to use when they visited. Wolsey relieved Henry of the more tedious chores of leadership and became the face of England to the diplomats and ambassadors who had official business with the House of Tudor. Some court visitors privately referred to Wolsey as another king. Early in his service, the ambassador from Venice noticed that Wolsey would indicate that orders and declarations came from His Majesty. Soon, Wolsey was using the term "we" when speaking for the king. Eventually, he simply said "I" when issuing royal statements. Wolsey's churchly titles rose to match his worldly power. As Lord Chancellor, he was made a cardinal, the highest Catholic prelate in England, outranking even the Archbishop of Canterbury. The Venetian ambassador suggested that it was more important to curry favour with Cardinal Wolsey than with the king. In France, Wolsey's influence was seen as undermining Henry's authority. Wolsey ran the courts, army, foreign policy, and all functions of the state. Parliament, which convened only once during Wolsey's chancellorship, was all but irrelevant. England was ruled by its king, and the king was ruled by Wolsey. Cardinal Wolsey became a wealthy man, collecting retainers as Lord Chancellor and his various church posts, and also from the many gifts he received in exchange for his influence at court. Some of these were courtesies extended to senior members of the court, but others were essentially fees Wolsey charged people who needed his help. But Wolsey was no mere money grubber out to undermine his monarch. He also sought and promoted able advisers to Henry to replace the conservatives he had removed. He chose the new men both for their intelligence and for their loyalty to him. Chief among them was Thomas Cromwell. Cromwell joined Wolsey's staff around 1516, when he was in his early 30s. Cromwell, a commoner from Putney, a dangerous borough of southwest London frequented by robbers, was a ruffian in his youth and may have served as a mercenary in the French army. He returned to London as a merchant with connections in the Low Countries. Wolsey appreciated Cromwell's diplomatic and administrative skills and made him first an advisor and eventually his personal secretary. Like Wolsey, Cromwell was disciplined, tough, and mindful of the prevailing political winds. Thomas More wasn't one of Wolsey's finds. He had known the king from Henry's boyhood, but he became another of Wolsey's closest court advisers. 13 years older than Henry, More, the son of a prominent London jurist, had become a noted lawyer, scholar, and member of Parliament. Deeply religious, he had contemplated the priesthood as a young man, and still observed certain ascetic traditions, such as self-flagellation, and, like Lady Margaret Beaufort, wore hair shirts. In many respects, More was a progressive thinker. In 1505, he married 17-year-old Jane Colt and began tutoring her in the classics. The couple had 4 children, 3 girls and a boy, and More insisted on the same classical education for all of them, even though girls did not generally receive advanced formal education in Latin or literature. But More was admired for it, and some noblemen at court soon began educating their own female children. When Jane died at 23, More shocked the court by remarrying less than a month later, this time to a wealthy, widely disliked widow, Alice Middleton. More was a talented writer, best known for his remarkable novel Utopia, portraying an idyllic society. But he was also a talented administrator, courtier, and diplomat, first named to the Privy Council in 1514. He worked closely with Wolsey on diplomatic missions and was knighted in 1521. As Sir Thomas More, he assumed the office of Under-Treasurer of the Exchequer and was made High Steward of Oxford and Cambridge Universities. More's career brought him ever closer to the king, as an advisor, confidant, and liaison with Wolsey. Wolsey's ascent was made possible not only by his talent and devotion to the king, but by his ability to set aside his beliefs when they ran contrary to Henry's wishes. This was especially true with respect to the king's keen desire for war against France. Henry had long wanted a war with France. In 1511, the French invasion of several territories north of Italy provided an opportunity for Henry to form an alliance against France with Maximilian I, the Holy Roman Emperor, together with Pope Julius II and Henry's father-in-law, Ferdinand II of Spain. In 1512, the Pope declared Henry the rightful King of France, though this had little effect in France. Many of the senior members of the Privy Council, objecting mainly to an expensive enterprise with an uncertain outcome, were against the alliance and the foreign war it portended.
There were moral objections too, notably from members of the English clergy, as well as the Dutch cleric and humanist Desiderius Erasmus, now in residence at Queen's College in Cambridge.
Renaissance humanism, originally centred in Italy, was spreading across Europe and bringing with it an increased willingness to question royal assertions as well as excesses of the Church. Wolsey shared these doubts. Nevertheless, well aware of the king's determination, he kept his views to himself and backed Henry's call to invade France. So did Catherine. The king listened to Wolsey, his wife, and their allies, and then he invaded. It did not go well. In the spring of 1512, an English army of 15,000 sailed for Spain, where Henry expected Ferdinand's forces to supply tents, provisions, and additional troops for an assault on France from the south. But arriving in Spain, the English discovered that Ferdinand had sent nothing to the front. Henry's army, sick and starving, returned home in October, having fought no battles and conquered no land. Henry was humiliated. Word spread across Europe that some on the continent, among them Maximilian I, thought the English no longer understood how to wage war. Inevitably, Henry's wrath found a closer target in Queen Catherine, although whether she was involved in her father's failure to do his part was beyond knowing. In Rome, rumours circulated that Henry might want to divorce Catherine, who, in addition to being a painful reminder of Spanish duplicity, had yet to provide the king with a male heir. To add further insult, King Louis XII of France hinted that he wanted to rekindle the War of the Roses by declaring the Duke of Suffolk, a member of the House of York, now imprisoned in the Tower of London, the rightful King of England. Henry dealt with the threat immediately. He had Suffolk beheaded and gave his title to one of his closest friends, Charles Brandon. Brandon's connection to Henry's family was complex and long-standing. His father, William Brandon, had been the standard-bearer for Henry VII at the Battle of Bosworth Field, where he had been killed by King Richard III. As a boy, Charles had lived in the royal household of Henry VII, and he and Prince Henry had grown up like brothers. Determined to show the world that he was a monarch in the tradition of Henry V, who had so memorably beaten the French at Agincourt, the king ordered Wolsey to raise a new and larger army that Henry himself would direct across the English Channel into France to join forces with Maximilian. The king wanted his own Agincourt. Wolsey assembled 25,000 well-supplied soldiers and a fleet to carry this army to France. His reward for this hard work was an invitation, along with Brandon and other cronies of the king, protected by a private guard of 300, to witness the invasion of France with Henry in the spring of 1513. Weeks after the main force landed at Calais, Henry and his cronies arrived in France and set up a small city of ornately decorated tents with a full complement of cooks and domestic servants. Henry even brought his own bed. The fighting amounted only to a few skirmishes. The few French forces the English met generally ran from Henry's larger army. The English captured a small town and then a larger city, while Maximilian's troops were having similar victories on other fronts. Charles Brandon commanded the army with considerable skill against an overmatched foe, while Henry remained in the rear, far from battle. There were rumours that he devoted some of his time to an affair with a young Flemish woman who disguised herself as one of Henry's pages in order to gain access to his quarters. Henry, meanwhile, staged tournaments, feasted, and then declared victory and sailed for England. When he arrived, he discovered that his wars against France had severely depleted his inheritance. He ordered Wolsey to raise taxes. Before his return, Henry learned that a force of Scots under their King James IV had invaded England from the north, attempting to take advantage of the king's absence. They hadn't counted on Catherine, however, who sent the English army to defeat the invaders, killing 10,000 Scots. James IV died in the fighting, and Catherine sent his bloody coat to her husband in France. In 1514, Wolsey played a key role in negotiating a treaty between England and France. He and the king also arranged the marriage of Henry VIII's younger sister Mary to King Louis XII of France. She was 18. He was 52. Mary Tudor was considered among the most beautiful princesses in Europe. At her wedding in October 1514, in Abbeville in Picardy, she wore her auburn hair in a loose cascade that reached her waist. The ambassador from Venice described the bride as a paradise, tall, slender, grey-eyed, and possessing an extreme pallor. Mary's wedding party included a striking young bridal attendant, the daughter of a diplomat and member of Henry VIII's court. Her name was Anne Boleyn. Mary's marriage was a brief one. Louis died within 3 months. It was whispered within the French court that the elderly king had succumbed to husbandly overexertions with his teenage bride. The new king of France, Francis I, sought to marry the young widow, but Mary wanted to return to England. Henry sent Charles Brandon to retrieve his sister. There was some risk in this. Mary and Brandon were in love and had been for some time. Fond as he was of Brandon, the king didn't want to lose the chance Mary provided him to make alliances with other monarchs. Henry made Brandon promise that he wouldn't marry his sister, but in the spring of 1515, Brandon and Mary defied the king and secretly married in France. When Henry heard of the marriage, he was enraged, as was the Privy Council. Since he had explicitly forbidden the marriage, it was technically treason, and the council recommended that Brandon be executed. Wolsey, however, came to the defence of Brandon and Mary and persuaded Henry to instead impose a large fine on the couple, equal to the unpaid dowry that France still owed for her. Henry acquiesced and even allowed them to be formally married at Greenwich Palace. But he had no more princesses to marry off, and his influence in Europe was waning. His ally and father-in-law, Ferdinand II, had died and was succeeded by the young and ambitious Charles V, who after the death of Maximilian would soon be vying with Francis I for the title of Holy Roman Emperor. Henry could only attempt to play the two against each other and the Pope. Chapter 4. Anne. Queen Catherine had not given Henry the heir he needed. Between 1510 and 1518 she was pregnant at least 6 times. All of the children were stillborn or died shortly after their birth, the single exception being a daughter, Mary, born in February 1516. Mary was a pretty, healthy, energetic child, and both Catherine and Henry doted on her. "If it is a daughter this time," said Henry, "by the grace of God, boys will follow. We are both still young." But this hope was doomed by the slow failure of their marriage. Henry would later admit that he and the Queen stopped having sexual relations in 1524. The problem of succession, which because of his father's tenuous claim as king was more complicated for the Tudors than for other royal families, still had no clear direction. While it was legally possible for a woman to ascend the throne, Henry knew that it would be difficult politically. If he were to die with no male heir, the House of York would reassert its claim to the crown. What might happen to Princess Mary if she were the only presumptive heir and civil war broke out? As early as 1514, rumours circulated in Rome that Henry might seek to have his marriage to Catherine annulled. At this point, the king seems to have been motivated not so much by Catherine's failure to deliver a male heir as by his close reading of the Book of Leviticus, which includes a prohibition against marrying a brother's widow. "And if a man shall take his brother's wife, it is an unclean thing. He hath uncovered his brother's nakedness. They shall be childless." It was a chilling biblical prophecy, though it's hard to understand how Henry could give credence to this warning after the birth of Princess Mary. He and Catherine had not remained childless, only heirless. After Anne Stafford, Henry had conducted affairs with an assortment of young women. In 1514, he became infatuated with a 14-year-old lady-in-waiting named Elizabeth Blunt. Charles Brandon also was smitten with her. He and the king exchanged notes about their flirtations with her, a signal of how familiar Brandon was with Henry. Henry kept up his affair with Blunt for several years, until in 1519 she disappeared from the court. The reason soon became clear. Blunt had delivered a healthy baby boy. Henry was the father. They named him Henry Fitzroy, Fitz signifying bastard, and Roy meaning king, and made him the Duke of Richmond. A suitable husband was found for Lady Blunt, as Henry wondered whether England would tolerate the accession of an illegitimate heir to the throne. It seemed doubtful, but the point was never contested. Fitzroy died in 1536 at the age of 17, while Henry was still alive. In 1520, Henry acquired a new mistress, Mary Boleyn. Born circa 1499, she was the older sister of Anne Boleyn, who had served as a maid of honour at Mary Tudor's wedding in 1514. Their father, Thomas Boleyn, was a diplomat who had carried out several successful missions for Henry VII. Born in Norfolk, they had spent their early years at Hever Castle in Kent, after their father inherited the property in 1505. In 1513, Anne was sent by her father to the Netherlands to study and live in the household of Archduchess Margaret of Austria, the daughter of Maximilian I. Margaret was fond of Anne's father, whose varied diplomatic missions across Europe had made him popular. In the Netherlands, Anne studied French and also learned to sing, dance, ride, and hunt. Her polished manners and refined sense of style made her particularly charming. Anne's older sister Mary, meanwhile, became a lady-in-waiting to Mary Tudor. When Mary Tudor went to France to marry Louis XII, Mary Boleyn accompanied her. Thomas Boleyn had asked Archduchess Margaret to release Anne from her charge so she could join her sister in the Tudor entourage, perhaps thinking the young woman would be a useful translator. But after Louis XII died, and Mary Tudor secretly married Charles Brandon, Anne Boleyn remained in Paris as lady-in-waiting to Queen Claude, wife of Francis I. Mary Boleyn, however, returned to the royal court in London, married one of Henry's lesser courtiers, and eventually became a regular visitor to King Henry's private chambers. In 1522, Sir Thomas Boleyn was made treasurer of King Henry's household. He knew of Mary's ongoing affair with the king, and in fact seemed to be actively promoting it. Many historians argue that Boleyn was willing to offer the king first one daughter and then another in the cause of his own advancement. Their evidence? Sir Thomas ordered Anne back to England, where he arranged for her to become lady-in-waiting to Queen Catherine. In truth, Thomas Boleyn brought Anne home partly because he hoped to make an advantageous marriage for her. He was attempting to resolve a long-standing family dispute that, with the right marriage for Anne, would have made him an earl, but also because France had become a dangerous place for English citizens. A year earlier, Henry had formed an alliance against France with Charles V, and was committed to sending another large invasion force across the Channel. The agreement was sealed with a royal betrothal, this time between Charles V and Princess Mary, who was 6 years old. This deal was rich with irony. 4 years earlier, when she was 2, Mary had been promised to King Francis I to cement Henry's alliance with France. For the next several years, England was convulsed with arguments over war. France was invaded twice, both times unsuccessfully, while Parliament and the public grew increasingly weary of the taxes Lord Chancellor Wolsey raised to pay for the fighting. Realising that the grumbling might soon turn into open revolt, Henry took a more moderate position, professing not to have been fully informed about the growing tax burden. In the interim, the balance of power on the continent had shifted, with Charles V looming as the greater threat to England. In 1525, Wolsey negotiated a new and unlikely peace treaty with France. Feeling betrayed, Charles V informed Henry that he would not marry Princess Mary. This latest peace with France had come 3 years after Thomas Boleyn had sent for his daughter Anne. She was now a fixture of the Tudor court. By most accounts, Anne Boleyn was beautiful, although her looks were in sharp contrast to the buxom, pale-skinned appearance considered desirable at the time. Anne was slender and fragile, with a small bosom and an olive complexion, this last feature amplified by her dark eyes and long, dark hair. She had a prominent, sharp nose and a narrow chin. Her enemies would later add many monstrous features to Anne's appearance, claiming that she had 6 fingers on one hand and a mole or wart on her throat, so unsightly that she always wore high collars. Anne was always impeccably dressed, a woman of definite opinions, and always sure of herself. In France, where she had been regarded as the fairest lady at court, it was said that she had the power to bewitch. As Henry VIII would learn, this was most definitely true. The young men of the French court had fallen under Anne's spell during her years in service to Queen Claude. She enjoyed parrying the advances of these would-be suitors, though years later those privy to inside information, including King Francis, would hint that Anne did not always say no. Even Henry VIII would eventually conclude that Anne had been corrupted in France. It isn't certain just when Henry first noticed Anne Boleyn. They might have seen each other in 1520 when Henry and Francis I conducted a meeting at Calais during a pause in the hostilities between England and France. It was an elaborate state meeting, and Anne would have been there as an attendant to Queen Claude. After returning to England and joining the court as a lady-in-waiting to Queen Catherine, Anne would surely have come to the king's attention almost immediately. He was, after all, conducting an affair with her sister. The first recorded occasion that put Henry and Anne together was at a party given for Henry and Catherine by Cardinal Wolsey in March 1522. After the formal banquet, a pageant was staged, with several of the most important guests recruited to play various parts and perform as dancers. The king was one of the players, as were Mary and Anne Boleyn. After the collapse of the marriage that her father had arranged for her, Anne spent more than a year at Hever Castle. During that time, she met a neighbour, Thomas Wyatt, a long-time adviser to Henry. Though he was never published in his lifetime, Wyatt was a poet, credited as being the first to write sonnets in English. At least a few of his lines have been interpreted by later scholars as evidence that he fell in love with Anne Boleyn. It's possible she returned his affection. Wyatt was a powerful and romantic figure, dashing, tall, and chivalrous, but he had also been humiliated by his wife, who conducted numerous indiscreet affairs. Wyatt's grandson, George Wyatt, wrote a book about Anne Boleyn in which he claimed that she and his grandfather were lovers. It is likely that Henry VIII thought there was an attraction between them. Wyatt was sent on a long mission to Italy in 1525, the year Henry gave Anne his full attention. Mary Boleyn was summarily dismissed. But when Henry expressed interest in Anne, she refused him. In the early winter of 1526, Henry rode in a jousting tournament wearing an embroidered motto that read, "Declare I not." Those present believed this phrase meant the king had a new lover whose identity had to remain secret. Later that same year, the king christened a new ship in his navy, the Anne Boleyn. He also lavished gifts on Anne, including jewellery custom-made by royal craftsmen, but their relationship was not proceeding as he hoped. According to George Wyatt's account, Henry's flirtation with Anne had been rebuffed. Anne professed to be shocked by the king's suggestion that she become his mistress. She said she wasn't worthy of the monarch, who already had a queen whom Anne loved and admired. In Wyatt's version, Anne told Henry, "I think your majesty speaks these words in mirth to prove me, but without any intent of degrading your princely self. To ease you of the labour of asking me any such question hereafter, I beseech your highness most earnestly to desist, and to take this my answer in good part. I would rather lose my life than my honesty, which will be the greatest and best part of the dowry I shall have to bring my husband." Acutely aware of the way the king had cast aside her sister, Anne didn't want to be Henry's mistress. She would have him only as his queen. It's possible that Henry encouraged her by confiding to Anne his growing belief that his marriage to Catherine was invalid. At some point, Anne felt confident enough to tell him bluntly, if he wanted her, he would have to marry her. And with that, the course of history was altered. Chapter 5. The King's Great Matter. Anne Boleyn's refusal to be Henry's mistress brought out a tenderness Henry had never shown before. In 1527 and 1528, Henry wrote Anne a series of love letters. Anne wrote back, of course, but only Henry's side of this correspondence has survived. In his early letters, Henry did nothing to hide his desire. On turning over in my mind the contents of your last letters, I have put myself into great agony, not knowing how to interpret them, whether to my disadvantage, as you show in some places, or to my advantage, as I understand them in some others, beseeching you earnestly to let me know expressly your whole mind as to the love between us two. It is absolutely necessary for me to obtain this answer, having been for above a whole year stricken with the dart of love, and not yet sure whether I shall fail of finding a place in your heart and affection, which last point has prevented me for some time from calling you my mistress. Because if you only love me with ordinary love, that name is not suitable for you, because it denotes a singular love, which is far from common. But if you please to do the office of a true, loyal mistress and friend, and to give up yourself body and heart to me, who will be and have been your most loyal servant, if your rigour does not forbid me, I promise you that not only the name shall be given you, but also that I will take you for my only mistress, casting off all others besides you, out of my thoughts and affections, and serve you only. I beseech you to give an entire answer to this, my rude letter, that I may know on what and how far I may depend. And if it does not please you to answer me in writing, appoint some place where I may have it by word of mouth, and I will go thither with all my heart. No more, for fear of tiring you. Written by the hand of him who would willingly remain yours. H. R. Not all the correspondence sings so soulfully of love. In one letter, an irritated Henry wrote that Anne was welcome to find a new apartment on her own if she didn't care for the one he had arranged for her, hoping she would at least remember his good intentions. In another, he complained that she had not responded to his last missive, and sent along a freshly killed deer he had shot himself, adding, "When you eat of it, you may think of the hunter." Sometimes Henry's rush of emotion resulted in long strings of free association. "My mistress and friend, my heart and I surrender ourselves into your hand, beseeching you to hold us commended to your favour, and that by absence your affection to us may not be lessened, for it were a great pity to increase our pain, of which absence produces enough, and more than I could ever have thought could be felt, reminding us of a point in astronomy, which is this: the longer the days are, the more distant is the sun, and nevertheless the hotter. So is it with our love, for by absence we are kept a distance from one another, and yet it retains its fervour, at least on my side. I hope the like on yours, assuring you that on my part the pain of absence is already too great for me. And when I think of the increase of that which I am forced to suffer, it would be almost intolerable, but for the firm hope I have of your unchangeable affection for me, and to remind you of this sometimes. And seeing that I cannot be personally present with you, I now send you the nearest thing I can to that. Namely, my picture set in a bracelet with the whole of the device, which you already know, wishing myself in their place, if that should please you. This is from the hand of your loyal servant and friend, H. R. Henry's earnest pursuit of Anne gradually won her over. She sent him a small gift, a jewelled figure showing a young woman on a boat at sea. Henry called it a beautiful present, and told Anne again how he longed to be forever in her favour. He added a Latin phrase to make the point, "Aut illic, aut nullibi," either there or nowhere. Henry went on to say that if Anne's affection for him remained constant, he would not merely reciprocate her love, but would try always to surpass it. Then he wrote a passage suggesting that he believed Anne was beginning to love him. Apparently, there had been some misunderstanding for which Anne had asked the king's forgiveness. Henry answered that it was he who should apologize. "I beg also," he wrote, "if at any time before this I have in any way offended you, that you would give me the same absolution that you ask, assuring you that henceforward my heart shall be dedicated to you alone." As time passed, Henry's involvement with Anne Boleyn was no longer secret. All of the nobility knew, including Queen Catherine, though she was more distressed that Henry had sent their daughter, 9-year-old Princess Mary, to Ludlow Castle on the Welsh border. Like her half-brother, the illegitimate Henry Fitzroy, Mary had been given a title, a remote castle, and a large household staff. Still hoping for a male heir, but also working to ensure the Tudor succession, Henry was trying to wrap both his children in the cloak of royalty so that either might one day ascend the throne. Henry also wanted his children away from London, where a 1525 outbreak of plague had killed many. Queen Catherine, who was close to her daughter and missed her terribly, was not permitted to visit her, though Mary made a few visits to the court, and on at least one occasion danced with her father. By the spring of 1527, the unravelling of Henry's marriage to Catherine had become inevitable. The king argued that the union could be annulled because it had never been proper. The Bible expressly forbade marriage to a brother's widow. While Henry's love for Anne Boleyn and his loss of interest in Catherine helped to finalise his thinking, they were not the deciding factors. More than anything, Henry wanted a male heir, and Catherine couldn't give him one. Anne Boleyn might. He had to extricate himself from his marriage. In this great matter, as he called it, he would not fail. That year, Anne Boleyn became a fixture in court, not only as Catherine's most beguiling lady-in-waiting, but as the king's constant companion. They dined and hunted together, attended parties in each other's company, and shared longing gazes in public. But that was the extent of their intimacy. Henry expected to get his annulment the way he got everything else. He ordered Wolsey to carry out his wishes. Wolsey was polite and tolerant of Anne Boleyn, though he considered her a woman of little consequence. Her appeal to Henry eluded Wolsey, which is perhaps why the cardinal failed to realise that she was a threat to him. When Anne returned to England with the promise of marriage to a nobleman, Wolsey saw to it that it was called off. Anne never knew that Henry had ordered the betrothal ended. She simply didn't like Wolsey. And if she secretly harboured reformist views toward the church, as some suspected, he was all the more objectionable for being its leading prelate in England. Queen Catherine also saw Wolsey as an enemy. She blamed him for encouraging the king to treat Henry Fitzroy and Mary as equal heirs to the throne. She knew that Wolsey's spies in court watched her and routinely intercepted and read her mail to determine what she was telling her family in Spain about the House of Tudor. Catherine understood Wolsey's hostility. He believed her family had betrayed England on numerous occasions. But she saw herself again falling out of favour, as she had been treated after Arthur's death, and she knew that Wolsey would be implacable in using his power against her. Thomas Howard, the Duke of Norfolk, also played a prominent role in this intrigue. Norfolk, a member of the Privy Council and arguably the most formidable nobleman in England, was also Anne Boleyn's uncle and had once been married to King Henry's aunt. Upon her death, Norfolk married Elizabeth Stafford, the same Elizabeth Stafford involved in the scandal over Henry's earlier affair with her sister Anne Stafford. Norfolk detested his new wife, but he loved the English court, and Henry considered him a wise counsellor. Norfolk and a number of other senior advisers had long resented Wolsey's enormous influence with the king. Detecting a potential ally in Anne Boleyn, this group began confiding in her. Soon, Anne found herself at the centre of a nascent anti-Wolsey movement. At the same time, her relationship with Henry entered a new phase. The king, having decided to end his marriage to Catherine, proposed to Anne, who said yes. Henry informed Thomas Boleyn, who was predictably thrilled. One daughter had merely seduced the king. The other would become his queen. Anne did not, however, budge on an important detail. She still refused to consummate her relationship with Henry until they were married. Acutely aware of the turmoil that surrounded her at court, Anne returned to Hever Castle, while Henry attempted to resolve his great matter. Lonely and impatient, Henry resumed his correspondence with Anne. Most of Henry's letters contained little news other than his longing to be with Anne, but in spring or summer of 1528, Henry received word that she had fallen ill. The king was alarmed. An epidemic of sweating sickness had swept London, and then England. Henry wrote Anne to tell her how worried he was about her, and sent one of his personal doctors to attend her. "I beseech you to be guided by his advice in your illness," Henry wrote. "In so doing, I hope to see you again, which will be to me a greater comfort than all the precious jewels in the world." Anne recovered quickly, but both she and Henry continued to worry about sweating sickness. He told Anne to stay at Hever Castle, as the air there seemed to agree with her and would keep her safe from the epidemic. At some point, Anne briefly returned to London. After she left again for Hever, Henry wrote to say how much he missed her. He complained of overwork that led to headaches, though he said this was a lesser pain than he felt from being parted from her. Part of the work that had been giving Henry headaches was a document he was writing in which he made the case for annulment of his marriage to Catherine. Though the king needed a divorce, what Henry truly wanted was a determination that he had never been rightfully married at all. Meanwhile, the king leaned on Wolsey, who expressed shock at Henry's desire to leave his marriage, and at first advised against pursuing such a course. Wolsey seemed to understand the potential perils of confronting Rome over a marriage that had already been granted a formal dispensation by the Pope. But as always, Wolsey bowed to the king's wishes. In the spring of 1527, he convened a formal inquiry into the matter, with himself and the Archbishop of Canterbury presiding over a court composed of several bishops and lawyers. The fiction of this hearing was that King Henry was being called to account for his actions and to say whether, as a matter of conscience, he had come to believe his marriage to his brother's widow was sinful, as if the king were being charged with a crime. Of course, it was the other way around. This argument was all Henry's, and investigation of his sin was entirely his idea. Henry was determined to be found guilty, and a decision against him would actually be a ruling in his favour. As Cardinal Wolsey was both his closest counsellor and an official papal legate, Henry fully expected to prevail. Wolsey spoke for the king and for Rome. As a legate of the Pope, Wolsey had wide latitude and jurisdiction over any ecclesiastical matter in England, and he could conduct this inquiry without having to formally charge the king with violating canonical law. But although Wolsey was required to hear testimony from all parties directly involved, he neglected to include Catherine among the witnesses. Catherine initially knew nothing of the proceeding, but inevitably heard about it, and immediately informed Wolsey that she would resist having her marriage annulled. Moreover, her defence included a crucial detail. Catherine claimed that her marriage to Henry's brother Arthur had never been consummated, thus removing any impediment to her marrying Henry. This came as a surprise to all. After his wedding night, Arthur had boasted that he had spent much of the night in the midst of Spain. It was also a shock to Henry, since it undermined his case for an annulment. The king himself had similarly testified in Wolsey's courtroom that he believed Catherine and Arthur had not consummated their marriage, but he had since found out that this was a tactical mistake that weakened his case. Catherine, now on her guard and determined not to be easily dismissed, said she would procure her own lawyers. Given the awkwardness of the premise for the hearing and the seriousness of the consequences, the court was stymied. After 2 weeks of hearings and private consultations, the judges admitted they could not reach a ruling. Henry's great matter would be sent to the Pope. Obsessed with his quest, the king was no longer the impulsive and happy young man who had once impressed visitors with his charm, humour, and common touch. He was becoming unfeeling and authoritarian. He regarded Catherine as his enemy. In many ways, she was Henry's match, except, of course, in the one that counted most. Henry was king. Catherine refused to believe that Henry wanted a divorce. When Henry finally told her directly that he felt their marriage was a fraud and that they were living in sin, she was mortified. Through her sobs, Catherine tried again to convince Henry that she had never consummated her marriage with Arthur, something he had professed to believe until it became an inconvenience, and that she had, in fact, still been a virgin when she married Henry. The king was unmoved. But he did concede, however disingenuously, that if he was wrong, and their marriage was indeed valid, he would endeavour to maintain it. Henry was eager to have his great matter turned over to the Pope. But only a month after Wolsey's inquiry ended, Charles V, the Holy Roman Emperor, and Catherine's nephew, had invaded Italy, begun a bloody occupation of Rome, and taken Pope Clement VII prisoner. Though this hadn't been Charles's objective, the sack of Rome had been carried out by mutinous troops who hadn't been paid, the Pope had been removed from the power structure of Europe, at least for the moment. Moreover, even if Clement were allowed to rule on Henry's annulment, it was unlikely that he would approve it while he was a prisoner of one of Catherine's relatives. Charles V made it amply clear that he wanted Catherine to remain married to King Henry. Henry's great matter was in limbo. Wolsey, trying to find a creative solution, and growing uneasy about his standing in court after failing to get the king what he wanted, offered to go to France to see if he could persuade Francis I to take Henry's side, and arrange for the Pope to put Wolsey solely in charge of deciding the case. Henry told the cardinal to proceed, but perhaps predictably, this mission too failed. Henry was irate that Catherine would stand in his way, not only preventing him from marrying the woman he loved, but also blocking his obsessive need to produce a legitimate male heir. He may have also convinced himself that their marriage actually was sinful, and that Catherine's refusal to consider his moral convictions was itself reason enough to be done with her. Catherine, of course, did not want to lose her title, but she also could not accept the fact that Henry no longer loved her. Catherine never gave up the idea that the king would cast Anne Boleyn aside and return to her. She even dreamed of having another baby with Henry, though she was now 42 years old, and it had been years since they'd had sexual relations. Catherine may have held out such hopes in part because, in spite of his case against her, Henry still treated her with civility, respect, and at least outwardly, quiet affection. Because Catherine refused to move out of the palace, the two learned to live peacefully with each other. Catherine tolerated Anne Boleyn as one of her ladies-in-waiting, and Henry behaved deferentially toward his queen in public. Catherine was beloved by the people, and the king knew that any discourtesy on his part would be viewed harshly. All the same, the truth that Catherine had fallen from the king's favour was soon common knowledge throughout England and across Europe. Most people believed Anne Boleyn was to blame. They called her a whore and a witch who had cast an evil spell on Henry. By the time Wolsey got to France for consultations with Francis I, the nature of the great matter had changed. At first, the only issue was the validity of Henry's marriage to Catherine. There had been no open discussion about what he would do or whom he might marry if an annulment were granted. Even those close to the king, Wolsey chief among them, held out hope that Henry might make a politically advantageous marriage in the future. But as it became clear that Anne Boleyn would be Henry's second wife, hopes for a calm resolution of the great matter faded. Henry also realised that his affair with Mary Boleyn effectively put him in the same position in which Catherine found herself. How could he marry Anne, having had carnal relations with Mary? King Henry sent an emissary to the Pope, still a captive of Charles V, asking him to grant a dispensation that would allow Wolsey to decide the validity of his marriage to Catherine, and also answer the question of whether he might then marry Anne Boleyn. The Pope met with Henry's representatives over several weeks in the spring of 1528. He expressed scepticism about Henry's motives, but after reading Henry's rationale for the annulment of his marriage, admitted that the king might have a sound argument. This was not what Henry hoped for.
Pope Clement sent a Roman cardinal, Lorenzo Campeggio, to England, where he was to join Wolsey in forming a new court to hear Henry's great matter.
But even the decision of this new court would not be the final word. Whatever they determined would require final review by the Pope. Life at court went on, constantly on the move as Henry shifted restlessly among his palaces, Richmond, Westminster, Windsor, Greenwich, Hampton Court, and the Tower of London were frequent destinations. In 1512, a fire destroyed the royal apartments at Westminster, and as Wolsey continued to enlarge Hampton Court, it became the king's favourite. But the court often comprised several thousand noblemen, clerics, councillors, and domestic servants, a huge and costly retinue that threatened to bankrupt any nobles unlucky enough to be favoured with a royal visit. partly to ease this burden, but also hoping to put the king in his debt, Wolsey gave his beloved Hampton Court to Henry in 1526. Chapter 6. Crisis in the Church. For Henry and Anne, the delays and uncertainties preventing their marriage were torture. For Wolsey, it must have been the same, as he felt himself falling out of Henry's favour. The king could see nothing but Anne Boleyn. Wolsey must have been dismayed when Anne wrote to him, with poisonous sweetness, about the stalemate. In her letter, she professed her utter devotion to the cardinal, and ended by saying that she was impatient for him to give her the news that she and Henry were waiting for. In what Wolsey may have read as a warning, Anne wrote that she was sure that you desire it as much as I.
In October of 1528, Cardinal Campeggio arrived in London with two surprises in store.
The first was for Henry. If, as the king insisted, he was motivated only by his belief that his marriage to Catherine was invalid, Pope Clement was prepared to offer a papal dispensation approving again of that union. Henry rejected the idea. The papal envoy's second surprise was for Catherine.
Campeggio suggested that she enter a nunnery and thereby put an end to all controversies.
Angry and guarded, Catherine said she would do no such thing. She told the cardinals again that she had never consummated her marriage with Arthur. 2 days later,
when Campeggio agreed to hear Catherine's confession, she repeated her claim.
As the months slipped by, Henry complained in writing to his Privy Council that Catherine was making too great a show of being queen, dressing ornately and making too many appearances among the public, where she was as popular as ever. At the end of 1528, the Spanish ambassador reported that Cardinal Wolsey appeared to be losing influence with an impatient Henry.
Still, at Christmas, Henry entertained Cardinals Wolsey and Campeggio at Greenwich, where both Catherine and Anne were present. Campeggio, seeing how deeply in love with Anne Boleyn the king was, reported to Rome that Henry already treated her as if she were his wife in every respect save one. Campeggio didn't think they were intimate.
In January 1529, Catherine sent her lawyers to Rome.
In June, Wolsey and Campeggio finally convened a formal hearing on the king's great matter at the Blackfriars Monastery in London.
It caused a sensation. Crowds lined the streets. No English monarch had ever been summoned to court. Catherine, when asked to give testimony, insisted that the court had no authority over the case, which she said must be decided by the Pope in Rome. Asked again, Catherine shocked the audience by walking to Henry and falling to her knees at his feet. Abashed, Henry could only sit and listen as the Queen spoke. She launched into a passionate speech, which was recorded by Wolsey's secretary. "Sir, I beseech you, for all the love that hath been between us, and for the love of God, let me have justice. Take of me some pity and compassion, for I am a poor woman, and a stranger born out of your dominion. I have here no assured friends, and much less impartial counsel. I flee to you as the head of justice within this realm. Alas, sir, wherein have I offended you, or what occasion of displeasure have I deserved, that you intend to put me from you? I take God and all the world to witness that I have been to you a true, humble, and obedient wife, ever conformable to your will and pleasure. I have been pleased and contented with all things wherein you had any delight or dalliance, whether it were in little or much. I never grudged in word or countenance, or showed a visage or spark of discontent. I loved all those whom ye loved, only for your sake, whether I had cause or no, and whether they were my friends or enemies. This 20 years and more I have been your true wife, and by me ye have had diverse children, although it hath pleased God to call them out of this world, which hath been no fault in me. And when ye had me at the first, I take God to be my judge, I was a true maid, without touch of man. And whether it be true or no, I put it to your conscience. If there be any just cause by the law that you can allege against me either of dishonesty or any other impediment to banish and put me from you, I am well content to depart, to my great shame and dishonour. And if there be none, then here I most lowly beseech you, let me remain in my former estate and receive justice at your princely hands. The king, your father, was accounted in his day as a second Solomon for wisdom, and my father Ferdinand was esteemed one of the wisest kings that had ever reigned in Spain. It is not therefore to be doubted that they gathered much wise counsel about them as they thought fit by their high discretions. Also, there were in those days as wise, as learned men as there are at this present time in both realms, who thought then the marriage between you and me good and lawful. It is a wonder to hear what new inventions are invented against me, who never intended but honesty, that cause me to stand to the order and judgment of this new court, wherein you may do me much wrong, if you intend any cruelty. For you may condemn me for lack of sufficient answer, having no indifferent counsel. Ye may understand that they cannot be indifferent counsellors, which be your subjects, and taken out of your counsel beforehand, and dare not, for your displeasure, disobey your will and intent. Therefore, most humbly do I require you, in the way of charity and for the love of God, who is the just judge, to spare me the extremity of this court, until I may be advised what way and order my friends in Spain will advise me to take. And if ye will not extend to me so much impartial favour, your pleasure then be fulfilled, and to God I commit my cause." Henry, who at one or two moments during this astonishing monologue appeared as if he wanted to lift Catherine off her knees, simply looked at her agape. Catherine stood up and walked out of the hall. The bailiff called after her to come back, but Catherine, staring straight ahead as she continued out into the sunlight, was heard to say, "On, on, it makes no matter, for it is no impartial court for me. Therefore I will not tarry. Go on."
Henry expected the court to issue its ruling a few weeks later, but in late July, Campeggio said he wanted to discuss the proceedings with the Pope and adjourned the court. Now it was Henry's turn to storm out of Blackfriars. Campeggio returned to Rome in September, taking with him a trove of evidence from the trial, Henry's love letters to Anne Boleyn. The correspondence was deposited in the Vatican archives, where it remains today. That summer, the king fumed over the arrival of a new ambassador from Spain. Eustache Chapuis, who made it clear from his first day at court that he was there in support of Catherine and her marriage to the king. This won him few friends. Members of the court despised Chapuis, who had a sharp wit and a sharper tongue. Whenever he was out of earshot of the king, Chapuis referred to Anne Boleyn as the concubine. The Boleyns hated Chapuis, but Anne focused on her primary enemy, Wolsey. When the Wolsey-Campeggio court adjourned without taking action, Anne decided that the cardinal was working against her and for Catherine.
At a banquet later that summer, Henry tried to repair his relationship with Wolsey, but the king's efforts were fruitless. Several noblemen overheard Henry being conciliatory with Wolsey and reported it to Anne, who was incensed. At dinner that evening, she told the king that if any other member of the royal court harboured as much animosity toward her as Wolsey, Henry would make him pay for it with his head. Henry pretended to be shocked, but 2 months later he relieved Wolsey of his title as Lord Chancellor and accused the cardinal of putting the Pope ahead of the King of England. Parliament dutifully produced an indictment of treason against Wolsey, but Henry, perhaps sensing the cardinal was already a broken man, ordered the matter dropped. Wolsey, in despair, and hoping to restore himself to the king's good graces, gave Henry a small palace called York Place. Henry immediately named it Whitehall and installed Anne there. There were no accommodations for Catherine. Defeated, Wolsey retreated to a house in the country. He was never asked back to court. The controversy around the king's great matter entered its final phase, though it would take several more years for it to reach its shattering conclusion. Chapuis reported to Spain that Anne Boleyn was effectively the Queen of England, and that she had become all-powerful, but she could not yet marry Henry. The annulment was still under review in Rome, and likely to remain that way indefinitely. Clement VII moved slowly. He was being asked to annul a marriage that an earlier pope had approved as valid, and under Catholic law a true marriage could not be easily dissolved by divorce. But Henry's great matter was even more problematic. It had enormous geopolitical implications. Spain wanted its native daughter to remain the Queen of England, but Henry was asserting his divine authority as king, something no other monarch wanted to quibble with. As the depth of Henry's obsession with Anne became apparent, there was growing concern that if Rome didn't capitulate, Henry would break from the Catholic Church so that he could marry her without interference. The case posed a major dilemma for the Pope. If he allowed the annulment, he effectively conceded that the Church was subservient to the state. But if Clement pushed Henry too far, he risked losing all of England. The power of the Catholic Church was under assault all over Europe. The siege had begun on October 31, 1517, when a German monk named Martin Luther walked up to the front door of the All Saints Church in Wittenberg and nailed to it a critique of the Church entitled 95 Theses. Luther, who was opposed to the Church's growing corruption and excesses and believed the Bible was the only authority on God's will, had been moved to action by the Church's sale of indulgences to raise funds for the construction of St. Peter's Basilica in Rome. An indulgence was essentially a cash payment to buy off punishment for some minor sin. Mortal sins that could prevent a person entering heaven technically could not receive an indulgence, although exceptions were made. A Dominican friar from Rome selling indulgences in Germany was reported to travel the countryside with this motto: "As soon as the coin in the coffer rings, a soul into heaven also springs." Luther saw indulgences as violating the concept of true contrition and repentance for sins, and he also assailed such churchly abuses as nepotism in the priesthood, usury in lending to the faithful, and the sale of sacred relics for profit. In one of the most pointed of the 95 Theses, Luther demanded, "Why does the Pope, whose wealth today is greater than the wealth of the richest Crassus, build the Basilica of St. Peter with money of poor believers rather than with his own money?" The effects of Luther's theses were immediate and widespread. In early 1518, the manifesto, which Luther had composed in Latin, was translated into German, printed, and spread across the country within weeks. It marched across the continent and reached England the next year. Indulgences were only the start of Luther's quarrel with the Church. He believed that in its corruption and venality, the Church had forsaken the core concept of Christian teaching, that of justification, which holds that faith in God is the only path to salvation. "This one and firm rock," Luther wrote, "is the chief article of the whole Christian doctrine, which comprehends the understanding of all godliness." The official reaction from Rome was slow. Pope Leo X seems to have been unsure whether Luther constituted a serious threat or was merely another in a long line of heretics and would-be reformers.
But in the fall of 1518, Luther was formally questioned in the city of Augsburg by Cardinal Thomas Cajetan, a papal legate sent to investigate this attack and arrest the monk if he could not be made to recant.
Under interrogation, Luther not only didn't recant, he declared that nothing in the Bible gave legitimacy to the papacy, and that biblical prophecies proved that the Pope was actually the Antichrist. That night, knowing the likely consequences of his defiance, Luther fled the city. Luther was excommunicated in the summer of 1520.
The following year, he was ordered to testify before the Diet, the Assembly of the Holy Roman Empire, at the town of Worms on the Rhine River. Luther's examination at the Diet of Worms lasted for several months.
During the proceedings, in one of the most revered speeches in history, Luther explained his refusal to recant. "Unless I am convinced by the testimony of the Scriptures or by clear reason, for I do not trust either the Pope or in councils alone, since it is well known that they have often erred and contradicted themselves, I am bound by the Scriptures I have quoted, and my conscience is captive to the Word of God. I cannot and will not recant anything, since it is neither safe nor right to go against conscience. May God help me. Amen."
The Diet of Worms found Luther to be a heretic and declared him an outlaw.
But while being returned to Wittenberg, he fled his captors again. Charles V, now Holy Roman Emperor, proclaimed that anyone was free to arrest or kill Luther on sight. But more people were interested in his ideas than in seeing him punished. By the mid-1520s, Luther had begun to organize his own church. The Protestant Reformation was underway. The Catholic Church, however, was still an inescapable fact of everyday life in England, where the king and the church shared temporal and spiritual authority. In the early 1500s, somewhere between 2.5 million and 3 million English Catholics were tended to by thousands of parish churches and as many as 800 monasteries. The English took their faith seriously and were avid churchgoers. Visitors from Europe marvelled that people in England attended Mass every day. Services, however, tended to focus more on day-to-day themes than on religious ones, and the priests doubled as reporters of current events, teachers, and social critics. Historian Philip Hughes describes a typical Mass. The sermon of those days was rarely dull. It was, to some extent, the main entertainment of the time, a keen, critical view of society, of the world, and all its fashions, set forth in racy, virile language, with witty and ruthless satire, even of the greatest of all, in church and state. Many people in 16th-century England, like others elsewhere in Europe, had issues with the powerful Catholic clergy. Priests, who insisted on pious and proper behaviour from their congregations, often set poor examples of those virtues. Monasteries, filled with treasures, owned vast tracts of the land and often treated their tenant farmers as little more than serfs. Powerful prelates hobnobbed with barons and earls and often seemed more interested in worldly power than spiritual concerns. Reform seemed inevitable. England's intellectual leaders were fascinated with Luther's ideas. At Cambridge, students who met to discuss Luther's doctrine of justification were so fervent that they were called Germans. Reform-minded priests began referring to Luther's ideas from the pulpit and attacking many of the trappings and dogmas of Catholicism. As head of the church as well as the state, Henry VIII had a delicate part to play. His subjects saw him mainly in his role as monarch, and most of them loved and revered him. But he had to maintain his relations with Rome, which meant both doing his duty as head of the English Church and making sure the Pope acknowledged all his power and prerogatives. As early as the winter of 1515, Henry was called upon to settle a complicated matter involving charges that several church officials had murdered a man they accused of being a heretic. The clergyman had been convicted by secular court. Henry had intervened and granted the convicted clerics a pardon. But the larger question remained, which was the greater authority, the king or the church? Did church officials in England answer to Rome or to Henry? A conference of experts, including Cardinal Wolsey, then at the peak of his power, convened to consider the matter. Wolsey steered a neutral course, advising Henry to consult with Rome, all the while knowing that the king would make his own decision. The king did just that, invoking the royal we. By the ordinance and sufferance of God, we are King of England, Henry said, and the kings of England in times past have never had any superior but God alone. Wherefore know you well that we shall maintain the right of our crown and our temporal jurisdiction as well in this point as in all others. The king's dual role had been mirrored in Wolsey's standing as both cardinal and Lord Chancellor. As calls for reform of the church grew, Luther and his ideas seemed more and more attractive to some of Henry's advisers. Thomas Cromwell, for one, was privately sympathetic to Lutheranism and was destined to become a leader of the Reformation in England. Members of the court increasingly complained about Wolsey's ties to Rome and his influence over the king. Wolsey had responded to the tide of reform with one of his balancing acts. He denounced Luther, but imposed his own harsh leadership to curb abuses in the church in England. He increased taxes on church officials and began closing monasteries, liquidating their assets, and using the proceeds on his own projects, which included building at least two colleges. Wolsey had also relieved the clergy of some traditional powers, such as adjudicating inheritances. But none of these achievements appeased a king who was infuriated by Wolsey's failure to make his case with the Pope. After toppling Wolsey, the king named as his new Lord Chancellor his longtime friend and mentor, Sir Thomas More. More endorsed the view that Henry's marriage to Catherine was invalid and could be annulled, but as a papal loyalist he was less willing to consider Henry's claim that the King of England was above the Church of Rome. More also opposed Lutheranism, which he regarded as heresy. This argument was not, for More, an abstract one. As Lord Chancellor, he actively hunted down Protestant reformers, ordered the burning of heretical books, and was widely believed to be behind the torture and burning at the stake of at least 6 heretics. More's promotion was no doubt partly intended as a signal to Rome that the king remained a loyal Catholic, but it would soon become a political problem for Henry, and a mortal danger for More. With the king, More had already taken a stand against the Reformation. When Luther published 3 books attacking Catholic doctrine in 1520, Henry enlisted More's help in composing a formal response. A document titled Assertio Septem Sacramentorum, Defense of the 7 Sacraments, which More later said was mostly Henry's work. In Assertio, Henry vigorously argued for the legitimacy of the Pope and the Church. Luther's arguments, he wrote, were absurd and impious. He worried that many people would be deceived by a false and wicked doctrine. Appalled at Luther's disparagement of all sacraments save baptism, Henry employed sarcasm to belittle the monk. What everybody believes, he alone by his vain reason laughs at. None of the doctors are so ancient, none so holy, none of so great authority in treating of holy writ, but this new doctor, this little saint, this man of learning, rejects with great authority. I am so far from holding any further dispute with him that I almost repent myself of what I have already argued against him. For what avails it to dispute against one who disagrees with everyone, even with himself? Who affirms in one place what he denies in another, denying what he presently affirms? Who, if you object faith, combats by reason? If you touch him with reason, pretends faith? Finally, he so undervalues customs, doctrine, manners, laws, decrees and faith of the Church, yea, the whole Church itself, that he almost denies there is any such thing as a Church, except perhaps such a one as himself makes up, of 2 or 3 heretics, of whom himself is chief. Henry's dismissal of Luther delighted Pope Leo X, who named Henry Defender of the Faith. That title was to become hopelessly ironic within a few years, but for a time Catholicism had no greater friend than Henry VIII. Chapter 7. A New Queen. Henry had now known Anne Boleyn for a decade, and had been in love with her for half as long. Anne was still young enough to marry and have children. The uncertainty about her birth date makes it an open question whether she was now closer to 20 or 30. Also, she was weary of waiting. When her patience wore thinner than usual, she would threaten to end the relationship with Henry and find another suitor. They always reconciled, but it became more difficult each time. Anne was especially vexed by Catherine's lingering presence. Ambassador Chapuis reported that Anne Boleyn was more arrogant every day, and that her hatred of Catherine was now apparent to all. Anne Boleyn said to one of the Queen's ladies that she wished all Spaniards were in the sea. The lady told her such language was disrespectful to her mistress. She said she cared nothing for the Queen, and would rather see her hang than acknowledge her as her mistress. Anne was aware that Charles V was working against her by insisting that the Pope order Henry to end their relationship. She also suspected that Wolsey, still a cardinal, was doing the same from his exile. Rumours persisted that Wolsey hoped to come back to Henry's court, but his return could take place only if the king's great matter were resolved in Catherine's favour and Anne banished. Anne and several of Henry's councillors managed to convince the sceptical king that Wolsey was lobbying for Henry's excommunication. Henry ordered Wolsey's arrest and sent men to take him to the Tower. Wolsey never made it that far. He fell ill and died on the road to London. The king's formerly indispensable man had been dispensed with forever. Throughout the negotiations and delays over the king's great matter, everyone involved was mindful that Henry might grow weary of the fight and simply marry Anne Boleyn, declare her the Queen of England, and leave the church to sort out the details. In early 1531, Henry appeared before Parliament and proposed that he be designated as the sole protector and supreme head of the Church of England. As historian Alison Weir put it, Henry was declaring himself king and pope in his own realm. He met little resistance, though several clerics and Sir Thomas More insisted on adding the phrase, "as far as the law of Christ allows," to the king's new designation. Parliament approved an act giving the king his new title, and it was promptly endorsed by a convocation of the clergy from Canterbury and York. For the moment, the English church was still nominally Catholic, but its leader no longer lived in Rome. A few months later, Ambassador Chapuis reported to Spain that Anne Boleyn was planning a wedding for the coming summer. He also wrote that she had become a devout Lutheran, an exaggeration, though Anne was eager for reform. She read a number of forbidden books, the sort that Thomas More burned, and made no secret of her wariness of the Catholic clergy, in her eyes supporters of Catherine. Anne's unpopularity made her uneasy. The English people were outraged when they learned that Anne Boleyn, not Queen Catherine, had spent the Christmas holidays of 1531 with Henry at the Royal Palace. A month earlier, an angry mob, made up mostly of women, gathered outside a house in London where Anne had joined friends for lunch. Then, on Easter Sunday of 1532, a priest brought to Greenwich to preach a sermon warned the king against making any unlawful marriage. Henry and Anne walked out. It was further trouble for Henry, who earlier that year had reluctantly accepted Sir Thomas More's resignation as Lord Chancellor. More, choosing his words carefully, made it clear that his conscience might permit him to approve an annulment of the king's marriage, but he could never condone the idea that the king was above the pope. More was also uncomfortable with the thought of Henry marrying Anne. He suspected she wanted to promote Protestant reform and might sway the king in that direction. But the king would soon get his desired reward. In August 1532, when the Archbishop of Canterbury died, Henry appointed Thomas Cranmer to the post. Cranmer was another of Wolsey's men, a Cambridge scholar, humanist, and ardent Catholic who had suggested that the king's great matter could be resolved without a papal review, simply by submitting it to academic authorities at several major universities. Cranmer had conducted the survey with results that favoured Henry's position, though the next step remained unclear. With Cranmer as his second in command in the Church of England, Henry was confident that he would win his annulment. Apparently, he convinced Anne Boleyn of the same, because she finally surrendered and joined the king in his bed. As Henry later reported, Anne was not sexually inexperienced after all, though this didn't seem to trouble him at the time. The ambassador from Venice reported that the king had a great appetite for Anne, while Chapuis informed Spain with disgust that Henry cannot leave her for an hour. By Christmas, Anne was pregnant. A month later, on January 25th, 1533, in a small, secret ceremony, Henry VIII married Anne Boleyn at Whitehall Palace. On May 23rd, 1533, Archbishop Cranmer declared Henry's 22-year marriage to Catherine of Aragon null and void, as it was contrary to divine law. 5 days later, Cranmer validated Henry's marriage to Anne Boleyn. "The king, in his blindness," Chapuis wrote, "fears no one but God." On the last day of May, Anne Boleyn was driven through the streets of London to Westminster, where a day later, on Sunday, June 1st, 1533, she was crowned Queen of England. Henry wanted her coronation to be more splendid than any in England's history. The celebratory procession to Westminster the day before the ceremony was half a mile long, with Anne, wearing a white gown trimmed with gold and ermine, riding in a canopy-covered litter carried by four knights. Along streets draped with tapestries and hangings, the procession paused occasionally for music, orations, or pageants in Anne's honour, praising her chastity and predicting that she would bear sons that would become Tudor kings. But there was a hollow feel to the festivities. Chapuis reported that they resembled a funeral rather than a pageant. With Henry absent, by tradition this ceremony was Anne's alone, Few people in the huge crowds doffed their caps or cried, "God save the Queen." Anne was not pleased, and told Henry so. For the next day's coronation in Westminster Abbey, Anne was again richly dressed, attended by 13 abbots, the monks of Westminster, the entire chapel royal, the bishops and clergy, and the lords in their robes of estate. She sat in King Edward's chair, which was draped in golden cloth, and Archbishop Cranmer placed the crown on her head. Then there was a banquet for 800 people at Westminster Hall, with each course served to the sound of trumpets, and Anne seated in the king's throne at a high marble table, served by 8 nobles. But to the chagrin of Henry, who was secretly watching from a latticed chamber, several prominent courtiers were absent, chief among them Thomas More. Celebratory dancing, feasting, and hunting continued for several days before the king and queen moved to Greenwich, where the revels continued. Even the death of Mary Tudor on June 25th caused only a brief pause in the merrymaking while she was buried, with all the honour due a queen, at Bury St. Edmunds in Suffolk. The festivity set the tone for the next year. Thomas More's daughter was to write him that there was nothing else in the court but sporting and dancing. Anne gave frequent feasts for Henry and had her own inner circle of ladies-in-waiting and gentlemen, mostly from the Privy Council, who entertained her with witty repartee and danced in her bedchamber. In the fashion of the day, they exchanged gifts and flirted, all in the chaste tradition of courtly love. Courtly love was a remnant of the age of chivalry. Its premise was that a knight could serve a lady, performing feats for her favour and yearning hopelessly for her love, while scrupulously respecting her chastity and defending her honour as the noblest of women. The convention had grown to include amorous teasing and exchanges of confidences, but husbands, including King Henry, accepted it as harmless. Courtly love was to remain a fixture in the English court for years. News of England's new queen was not well received in Rome, where Pope Clement in July declared Henry's new marriage invalid. A month later, the Pope drafted an order of excommunication for Henry, but Catherine pleaded with him not to issue it. If Henry were to be banished from the church, any hope she had of reconciling with him or regaining her title as queen disappeared. The Pope, in turn, softened his order. The king would be excommunicated if he didn't renounce Anne by September. Henry refused, and the threat remained hanging. Similarly, Henry sent members of the Privy Council to order Catherine to give up her title as queen or be charged with treason. She too refused, and Henry moved her to less comfortable living quarters at Buckden Towers in Huntingdonshire, with a much reduced staff. Meanwhile, Anne was working to obliterate all traces of Catherine from Henry's many palaces, replacing her crest with Anne's own coat of arms, initials, and falcon symbols. At Hampton Court, new and luxurious chambers and a new garden were built for the King and Queen on the first floor. The royal quarters dazzled the eye with a plethora of silver, gold, and jewels on display. Persian tapestries festooned the walls, and Henry's privy chamber had an alabaster fountain set into one wall. As Anne's pregnancy was coming to term, Henry took a mistress. Chapuis speculated that certain noblemen at court had set up the affair out of resentment of Anne, though this seems unlikely. These same men had conspired with Anne to remove Wolsey. Anne was livid over Henry's infidelity, Chapuis told Emperor Charles, berating him with certain words which the king very much disliked. But Henry retorted that she must shut her eyes and endure, as her betters had done. She ought to know, the king added, that he could degrade her as easily as he had made her queen. Still, Anne was about to make the king a father again, and he was planning jousts and feasts to mark the birth. The royal astrologers and physicians were unanimous that the child would be a boy, and the king was debating whether to name him Edward or Henry. Letters announcing the birth of a prince were written, and ready to be sent to nobles in England and the crowned heads of Europe. Then, on September 7th, 1533, at Greenwich Palace, Anne gave birth to a red-haired girl. The infant, named Elizabeth, would grow up to become one of England's greatest monarchs, but that was far in the future, and it did nothing to satisfy Henry's yearning for a male heir. Henry and Anne did little to hide their disappointment. The waiting letters had been dispatched after the word prince was changed to princess, and across Europe the arrival of a girl was widely perceived as God's punishment for Henry's illegal marriage. But Henry soon decided to go ahead with the planned celebrations and made grand plans for the baby's christening. It was a sort of insurance policy, a long-shot wager that if he didn't have a son, she might still be queen. While Elizabeth was widely seen as illegitimate, in official England she now took precedence over her half-sister Mary, who was ordered to give up the title of princess. When Mary defiantly refused, she too was moved to humbler quarters. Mary, now 17, also forfeited her jewellery to Elizabeth and was humiliated by being appointed a lady-in-waiting to the baby girl. Most of the court and all the dignitaries of London travelled to Greenwich for Elizabeth's christening. The baby, in purple velvet and ermine, was baptised by the Archbishop of Canterbury under a crimson canopy, and then triumphantly carried to Anne's bedside by the light of 500 torches. Soon, three-month-old Elizabeth was given her own household at Hatfield in Hertfordshire. Lady Margaret Bryan, who had cared for Princess Mary in her childhood, was appointed Elizabeth's governess, and Lady Margaret Douglas, one of those cut from Mary's retinue, was the baby's first lady-in-waiting. But Henry and Anne visited their daughter only rarely, content with regular reports on her well-being. Henry had another affair while Anne was recovering from childbirth, and by November there were rumours that the king was no longer in love with his queen. But he had not given up hope for an heir. By the new year, Anne was again pregnant, but she suffered a miscarriage or stillbirth in the summer of 1534. Even before the loss of the baby, Henry was concerned with the succession in case he didn't have a son. In March 1534, he persuaded Parliament to pass a law that overturned centuries of tradition. The Act of Succession declared that the Crown of England would pass to the children of Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn, with no mention of their gender. And Parliament went further, stipulating that anyone who publicly disparaged either the King's marriage to Anne or the legitimacy of their children could be charged with high treason. The Act formally asserted the King's supremacy in all matters. Henry was answerable to no one but God. Finally, there was a provision requiring an oath of allegiance to the Act from anyone who was asked to swear to it. That same month, Pope Clement, apparently unconcerned that events had passed him by, at last ruled on Henry's request for an annulment of his marriage to Catherine. He refused it. The Pope ordered the King to return to Catherine, his lawful wife and Queen of England. Catherine was elated, fully expecting Henry to comply and make her queen again. But Henry maintained that the Pope could not give orders to the King of England. Henry's defiance of the Pope opened the door to wide reform in the English Church. Thomas Cromwell, now Henry's personal secretary and chief adviser, ordered every member of Parliament and all of the prominent clergy to swear allegiance to the Act of Succession. Two men refused. One was John Fisher, Bishop of Rochester, the man Margaret Beaufort had hoped King Henry would take as his mentor. The other was Sir Thomas More. More had hoped to live quietly after retiring from the court, but he was already in conflict with Henry. He had not attended Anne's coronation and was accused of accepting bribes, though the charges proved false. But More's refusal to take the oath posed a problem for the king. More was respected and influential, and Henry feared his silence would inspire others to outright defiance. In April 1534, More was arrested for treason and taken to the Tower of London, where he would stay for more than a year. Thomas Cromwell repeatedly called on him, imploring More to take the oath and save himself. But More was standing by his conscience and relying on a subtle technicality that might allow him to avoid conviction. Though he had refused to take the oath, he had never explicitly denied Henry's supremacy. It was a shrewd legal move by a shrewd lawyer. A precedent held that remaining silent on a given proposition was the same as agreeing to it. By refusing to take the oath but also not contradicting it, More hoped he could follow his conscience and still avoid the executioner's axe. "I am the king's faithful subject," More told Cromwell. "I say no harm, I think no harm, but I wish everybody good. And if this be not enough to keep a man alive, in good faith I long not to live." To his anguished family, More said he depended first on God and then on the king, according to the lesson his highness taught me at my first coming to his noble service. In the prosecution of More, Cromwell proved an equally gifted lawyer, but in his ascent to power, Cromwell hadn't always been wholly scrupulous. He could charm people, but he could also intimidate them with the threat, overt or implied, of a treason charge, and he bent many to his will this way. Through his many contacts and a network of paid informers, he had a trove of sensitive, confidential information that he stored away for future use against anyone he or the king wanted silenced. Now, as the king's chief adviser, Cromwell knew how to cut through the Gordian knot of More's subtle defence. When More was brought to trial in July 1535, Cromwell produced a surprise witness against him, the king's solicitor general, Richard Rich. A month earlier, Rich had testified against John Fisher at his trial for treason. Fisher had been convicted and was beheaded on Tower Hill on June 22, 1535, where his body was stripped and left on the scaffold for the remainder of the day. At More's trial, Rich maintained that More had confided to him that he did not accept King Henry as the head of the church in England. At least two witnesses contradicted this transparent lie by Rich. The canny More would never have made such a statement to one of the king's men. Sir Thomas himself then rose to deny Rich's allegation. He said he considered Rich dishonest, and that it was foolish to think he would ever take such a man into his confidence. Surveying the court, which consisted of privy councillors and other noblemen, many of whom who had visited the tower to beg More to take the oath, More said they all knew that what Rich said could not be true. He had never confessed his private thoughts on the act of succession to the king or to anyone else, and he never would. It's difficult to believe that the court truly doubted More, but he had been charged with treason by the king, and few of the judges wanted to face Henry's wrath. The court took 15 minutes to convict More of treason and sentence him to death and other penalties. The condemned man was to be drawn on a wicker hurdle behind a horse to a gallows, hanged until not quite dead, then emasculated, disembowelled, and quartered. The king commuted More's sentence to decapitation. Sir Thomas went to the block on July 6, 1535. Before the axe fell, he said that he died the king's good servant, but God's, first. That day, Henry went hunting, presumably to distract himself from the fact that he was executing a man who had served him loyally for decades, and whose conscience was so firm that he would sooner die than say something he did not believe. Henry later convinced himself that More's execution had been a grave injustice, one he blamed on Anne Boleyn, and not entirely without cause. Anne had urged Henry to execute both Fisher and More when they refused the oath. When the king had his change of heart and rebuked her for dooming More, Anne tried to ignore his ranting, but she must have felt a tinge of panic. Where did she stand in Henry's affections? Henry's descent into cruelty and callousness may have had a medical cause that also explains much of his physical deterioration in later life. A prime specimen and keen thinker as a young man, in middle age he showed significant paranoia, anxiety, depression, and memory loss. By the time he died, he had ballooned to nearly 400 pounds and suffered from weakness and leg ulcers. Some contemporary medical researchers believe the king had a rare genetic disorder called MacLeod syndrome. Carried on the X chromosome, it affects primarily men over 40, with symptoms including heart disease, movement disorders, and psychological symptoms, among them paranoia and mental decline. That theory, of course, can no more be proved than the genetic explanation for Henry's wife's miscarriages. In any case, his new callousness came at the same time he was decreeing wholesale reform of the church. In 1535, the king named Cromwell England's Vicar General and ordered him to undermine the papacy. Cromwell began a sweeping review of all the churches and monasteries, searching out abuses, misappropriation of funds, and loyalty to Rome. Uprisings protesting the crackdown were ruthlessly suppressed, and their leaders were executed. Many religious houses were closed and liquidated, with their assets forfeited, not to the Church of England, but to the king. Henry's treasury swelled as Catholicism faded from England. The royal marriage, meanwhile, was showing signs of strain. The king and queen were observing the formalities of a married couple, but by mid-1535 they were barely speaking. Anne's physical charms had faded, and her personality chafed Henry. She had strident opinions and a hot temper. She was not discreet and decorous as he believed a queen should be. She argued with him in public and berated him for infidelity. She even appeared bored in his company. Chapter 8. Off with her head. Henry had found a new love late in 1535. Jane Seymour, a descendant of King Edward III, had been a lady-in-waiting to Catherine before taking on the same duties for Anne. At 27, Seymour was old to be still unmarried, but she was quiet, demure, and thoroughly schooled in the etiquette expected of a woman of high position. Some thought her pretty, but Chapuis, blunt as always, reported that she was no beauty. He found her intelligent, but not witty and entertaining as Anne was. Henry's interest in Jane generated considerable talk about her virtues, though Chapuis, who believed any woman who spent more than a few days at the Tudor court was surely corrupted, doubted that she was the maiden he thought she pretended to be.
What Henry saw in Jane was that she was pliable, willing to bend to the king's wishes, and perhaps the woman to give him a son at last.
In short, she was not Anne Boleyn. Anne soon discovered Henry's infatuation with Jane. On one occasion she blundered into a room where Jane was sitting on the king's lap. Another time the queen spied a new locket hanging from Jane's necklace and demanded to see it. There was a portrait of Henry inside. The king and queen argued loudly over Jane. Early in 1536, Catherine of Aragon was dying. On Henry's orders she was confined to one room in Kimbolton Castle in the Fens, and there were rumours that she was being slowly poisoned by agents of Henry or Anne. Catherine was attended only by her physician, her confessor, an apothecary, and three women who cooked and tasted her food in her presence. After her death in January 1536, an autopsy did nothing to dispel the rumours, since it found a suspicious black mass near her heart, a clue to today's medical researchers that her illness was cancer of the heart. Catherine sent Henry a final letter, declaring her love and faithfulness, and concluding, "Mine eyes desire you above all things." It was signed defiantly, "Catherine the Queen." Henry wept as he read it, and he and Anne appeared in court in mourning. But they were clearly triumphant that Catherine was gone, relieving them not only of potential unrest at home, but of the threat of war with Charles V, who had upheld her cause from the beginning. Later that month, Henry was injured in a joust when he was thrown from his horse, and the animal fell on top of him, crushing his leg. The king was unconscious for 2 hours. Royal physicians were sure he would die, and the Duke of Norfolk was sent to tell Anne the dire news. Although Henry recovered, his leg never fully healed, and his physical vigour diminished. That accident alone may be enough to explain many of his mental and physical problems as he aged. Had Henry died, the act of succession notwithstanding, England would probably have fallen into civil war. The king's escape from death was a boon for Anne. But on January 29th, the day of Catherine's funeral, Anne had another miscarriage after 15 weeks of pregnancy. The child was a boy, and both king and queen were devastated. Anne said she had miscarried because of her distress at Henry's infidelities and her shock at being told of his death. But Chapuis reported that the king had said to one of his courtiers that he had been seduced by witchcraft into marriage, and therefore considered the union null and void. After all the years of pursuit, patience, conniving, and eventual consummation, Henry was beginning to wonder, had he been under a spell? Was Anne his true wife? More to the point, what did any of it matter if she failed to give him a son? Visiting her on her sickbed, the king said bitterly, "I see that God will not give me male children. When you are up, I will speak to you." Yet Anne still had the power to bewitch Henry. The king and queen had another reconciliation, and the evidence suggests that Anne quickly became pregnant again. All through February, March, and April of 1536, Alison Weir writes, Anne was in a surprisingly strong position at court, spending lavishly on clothing and furnishings for herself and two-year-old Elizabeth. In April, Henry wrote to three of his ambassadors about his most dear and entirely beloved wife, the Queen, and the likelihood and appearance that God will send us heirs male. While it wasn't a direct announcement, he clearly wanted them to spread the news that an heir might be coming and that he was still a potent and vigorous king. If Anne was back in favour, however, it was for procreation, not romance. The king was still enamoured with Jane Seymour, and she applied one major lesson from Anne Boleyn, the power of saying no. In March, when Henry sent her a letter with a purse of gold sovereigns, she gave them both back to the messenger, declaring that she could accept a dowry from the king only when she found a husband. Henry promised that he would visit or speak to her only if one of her relatives was present. And later that month, Cromwell obligingly gave up his rooms at Greenwich, which had secret access to the Privy Chamber, and Sir Edward and Lady Seymour moved into them to serve as chaperones when the king discreetly visited Jane. The queen heard about this cosy, if chaste, arrangement, and was furious at Cromwell for facilitating Henry's infatuation. On April 1st, Cromwell confided to Chapuis that Anne hated him and wanted him executed. The two diplomats began a delicate dance. Cromwell asked Chapuis how Charles V would react to the king's remarriage. Chapuis replied that the world would never acknowledge Anne as Henry's true wife, but might accept another lady. The ambassador was already calculating that Jane Seymour thought well of the former Princess Mary, Catherine's daughter. If Mary could be restored to court, a new alliance between England and Spain would be possible. For Cromwell, the Queen's enmity was a potential disaster, a threat to his power, his career, and even his life. Her hold over the king still seemed strong, and it might last as long as Henry believed she could give him an heir. If she bore a son, she would be invincible. Cromwell began to consider how Anne could be safely gotten out of the way. Anne knew that her king was slipping away and began to worry about a divorce. Perhaps as a first step toward that end, Henry accused her of witchcraft. Within a month, they were separated. Anne went to live at Greenwich with Princess Elizabeth. Chapuis, channeling the wishes of Spain and Charles V, informed Henry how happy they would be to see Jane Seymour become the Queen of England. By the end of February, Charles proposed a new alliance with England, an alliance that Henry understood would be much more stable without the presence of Anne Boleyn. The king turned once again to Thomas Cromwell. Cromwell retreated to his home in the country and prepared a damning criminal case against Anne. The charges? Adultery and plotting the king's assassination. High treason, punishable by death. Cromwell was apparently inspired by rumours, quite likely true, that Queen Anne sometimes admitted men to her private quarters for more than courtly activities. Some scholars believe it's possible that Anne had taken lovers in the desperate hope of conceiving a boy that Henry would believe to be his own. It's unlikely, however, that Anne Boleyn would have conspired to have Henry killed, since without her husband she would certainly have been forced from the royal court, and Princess Elizabeth's claim to the throne would have been in jeopardy, no matter what the Act of Succession said. Near the end of April of 1536, Cromwell informed Henry that he had assembled evidence that Anne had committed adultery with five men of the court, including a prominent nobleman named Sir Henry Norris and Anne's own brother, George Boleyn. This charge of incest was a thoroughly Cromwellian touch, intended to quell any sympathy for Anne and ensure that Henry would be seen as the victim of a wicked woman. Cromwell persuaded Henry that the charges were true. Within days, all five men were arrested and taken to the Tower. One of them, Mark Smeaton, a musician and dancer in the Queen's household, confessed after being tortured on the rack. The others professed their innocence. Cromwell produced seemingly strong evidence that Anne had plotted the king's murder, planning to marry one of her lovers and rule as regent for the child she was carrying. Henry was devastated. Not only had she betrayed him, but the paternity of the unborn baby was now in doubt. There was no more reason to protect the queen, and every incentive to be rid of her and marry Jane Seymour. Most historians believe Anne was not guilty and that the 22 charges against her were false, but with the king's mind thoroughly poisoned, she was doomed. On May 2, 1536, soldiers came for Anne Boleyn. By most accounts, the queen was hysterical when she arrived at Traitor's Gate and entered the Tower. She remained insensible for several days. But on May 6, she calmly wrote Henry a long, defiant letter, proclaiming her innocence and that of the men accused with her. She reminded Henry of how long he had loved her, and of how completely she loved him back. "Sir, your grace's displeasure and my imprisonment are things so strange unto me, as what to write or what to excuse I am altogether ignorant.
Whereas you send unto me, willing me to confess a truth and so obtain your favour, by such a one whom you know to be my ancient professed enemy.
I no sooner received this message by him than I rightly conceived your meaning, and if, as you say, confessing a truth indeed may procure my safety, I shall with all willingness and duty perform your demand. But let not your grace ever imagine that your poor wife will ever be brought to acknowledge a fault where not so much as a thought thereof proceeded. And to speak a truth, never prince had wife more loyal in all duty and in all true affection than you have ever found in Anne Boleyn, with which name and place I could willingly have contented myself, if God and your grace's pleasure had been so pleased. Neither did I at any time so far forget myself in my exaltation or received queenship, but that I always looked for such an alteration as I now find. For the ground of my preferment being on no surer foundation than your grace's fancy, the least alteration I knew was fit and sufficient to draw that fancy to some other object. You have chosen me from a low estate to be your queen and companion, far beyond my desert or desire. If, then, you found me worthy of such honour, good your grace, let not any light fancy or bad counsel of mine enemies withdraw your princely favour from me. Neither let that stain, that unworthy stain, of a disloyal heart toward your good grace, ever cast so foul a blot on your most dutiful wife and the infant princess your daughter. Try me, good king, but let me have a lawful trial, and let not my sworn enemies sit as my accusers and judges. Yea, let me receive an open trial, for my truth shall fear no open flame. Then shall you see either my innocence cleared, your suspicion and conscience satisfied, the ignominy and slander of the world stopped, or my guilt openly declared. But if you have already determined of me, and that not only my death, but an infamous slander, must bring you the enjoying of your desired happiness, then I desire of God that he will pardon your great sin therein, and likewise mine enemies, the instruments thereof, and that he will not call you to a strict account of your unprincely and cruel usage of me at his general judgment seat, where both you and myself must shortly appear, and in whose judgment I doubt not, whatsoever the world may think of me, mine innocence shall be openly known and sufficiently cleared. My last and only request shall be that myself may only bear the burden of your grace's displeasure, and that it may not touch the innocent souls of those poor gentlemen who, as I understand, are likewise in strait imprisonment for my sake. If ever I found favour in your sight, if ever the name of Anne Boleyn hath been pleasing in your ears, then let me obtain this request, and I will so leave to trouble your grace any further with mine earnest prayers to the Trinity to have your grace in his good keeping, and to direct you in all your actions. From my doleful prison in the Tower, this 6th of May, your most loyal and ever faithful wife, and Boleyn. Whatever Henry thought of this remarkable document, he refused to relent. He avoided being seen in public during her imprisonment. Lodgings were found for Jane Seymour on the river near Hampton Court, so Henry could visit her by barge. He dined frequently with his ladies, also on the barge, and once had supper with the Bishop of Carlisle, who reported later that the king had told him he believed more than 100 men had enjoyed Anne's favours. On May 10th, 4 of the defendants, all but Anne and her brother, were tried at Westminster. As expected, they were convicted and sent back to the Tower to await execution. On May 15th, Anne and George Boleyn were tried at the Tower of London, where a grandstand for some 2,000 spectators had been erected. Anne remained calm, articulate, and resolute. But the inevitable guilty verdict was unanimous. The Duke of Norfolk, Henry's trusted adviser and Anne's uncle, read the sentence of the court. "Because thou hast offended our sovereign King's grace, thou shalt be burned here within the Tower of London on the green, else to thy head smitten off, as the king's pleasure shall be further known of the same." Then the duke burst into tears. Anne spoke a final time, again insisting on her innocence and aiming her words carefully at the man who had once pursued her so ardently. "I do not say that I have always borne towards the king the humility which I owed him, considering his kindness and the great honour he showed me, and the great respect he always paid me. I admit, too, that often I have taken it into my head to be jealous of him. But may God be my witness if I have done him any other wrong." The court was cleared, and George Boleyn was brought before the judges. In the same manner as his sister, he was quickly convicted. To prevent the king from having second thoughts, Cromwell and several other advisers continued to provide Henry more fictional evidence of Anne's guilt. Based on their tales, Henry's anger deepened. The executions were inevitable, but the king showed one small kindness to Anne. He ordered her to be beheaded rather than burned at the stake. He then took the trouble to arrange for a headsman from Calais, who used a sword instead of an axe. This permitted the condemned to die kneeling upright rather than bent over a block. George Boleyn and the other men were executed on the morning of May 17th on Tower Hill. Henry had also commuted their sentences to beheading, and each man went in turn to the block. In a cruel turn, Anne was moved that morning to the bell tower overlooking the hill. Whether she watched the proceedings isn't known, but she certainly heard the condemned making their final speeches and followed the fall of the axe and the hoots of the attending crowd. Afterward, Anne was returned to her former cell overlooking the green of the tower's inner yard, where workers were building a scaffold. She would climb it in 2 days. Anne Boleyn was to be executed on the morning of May 18th. By all accounts, she had prepared herself to die with dignity. Even Cromwell admitted that he was impressed. But she was upset when she learned that the headsman coming from Calais had been delayed at Dover, and she would have to wait until noon. Anxious to end matters, she joked, "I have heard the executioner is very good," she said, "and I have a little neck." Midday came and went. The execution was put off until the following morning. Outwardly calm, but in excruciating anxiety, Anne spent the night talking with her ladies and praying. At 9 o'clock on the morning of May 19th, Anne Boleyn was led onto the Tower Green. She mounted the scaffold, which was draped in black cloth. The hooded headsman stood waiting, his sword hidden behind him, and as many as 3,000 people looked on. Thomas Cromwell was among them. Anne looked exhausted but composed. She wore a dark robe trimmed in fur. She asked to address the crowd. "Good Christian people, I am come hither to die according to law, and therefore I will speak nothing against it. I come here only to die, and thus to yield myself humbly to the will of the King, my Lord. And if, in my life, I did ever offend the King's grace, surely with my death I do now atone. I come hither to accuse no man, nor to speak anything of that whereof I am accused, as I know full well that aught I say in my defence doth not appertain to you. I pray and beseech you all, good friends, to pray for the life of the King, my sovereign lord and yours, who is one of the best princes on the face of the earth, who has always treated me so well that better could not be. Wherefore I submit to death with good will, humbly asking pardon of all the world. If any person will meddle with my cause, I require them to judge the best. Thus I take my leave of the world and of you, and I heartily desire you all to pray for me." Anne then prayed a final time with a priest. She removed her hood. Her hair was bound up to expose her neck. As was customary, she handed the headsman a purse containing his payment. As she sank to her knees, many in the crowd knelt with her. A hush fell over the green. The executioner drew his sword and severed Anne's neck with a single blow. As her blood ran over the dark cloth on the scaffold, the executioner held up her head. It was less than 2 months since Cromwell had first presented the charges to the king. Despite the elaborate preparations undertaken for Anne's execution, no proper coffin had been provided. At the last minute, someone found an arrow chest in the tower's armory, dumped out its contents, and dragged it to the foot of the scaffold. Cannons fired from the tower as Anne's body and head were unceremoniously loaded into it and taken away. The infant Elizabeth remained in the care of Lady Bryan. Perceptive and sensitive, she was soon wondering why people were calling her My Lady Elizabeth instead of My Lady Princess. It isn't recorded how and when she learned what had happened to her mother, but Lady Bryan soon had to beg Cromwell for funds to replace the clothes Elizabeth had outgrown. The king's great matter had been settled once and for all. As long as he lived, Henry never again spoke Anne Boleyn's name. Chapter 9. The Restless King. The day after Anne's execution, the king and Jane Seymour were engaged at Hampton Court. Then they moved to the palace at York Place, which Parliament soon renamed the Palace of Westminster and designated as the king's principal residence and the seat of government. 10 days later, on May 30th, they were married at Whitehall. The king was now 45 years old, a man's average lifespan in those days. He still had an impressive physique, with a waist his armourers measured at 37 inches and a chest of 45 inches. But foreign envoys were no longer praising his looks. He was balding, and his face was sagging into the jowly rectangle of his later portraits, with narrow, close-set eyes and a small, pursed mouth. His formerly idealistic and liberal mind had narrowed too, becoming contrary, dogmatic, and secretive. Courtiers feared his temper, and his egotism was suffocating. "He never forgets his own greatness, and is silent as to that of others," said a French diplomat. It has been suggested that this changing persona was a sign that the king was impotent, but evidence suggests otherwise. 6 months after her marriage, Jane Seymour was pregnant, and there's no sign that Henry had given up his extramarital pursuits. Jane Seymour was named queen on June 4, 1536, at Greenwich, and 3 days later the king and queen came to London by barge for a high mass at Westminster Abbey. As they passed the tower, where Anne Boleyn had lain in her arrow-chest coffin for less than 3 weeks, streamers and banners waved from the walls and 400 guns sounded salute. In all the royal palaces, armies of workmen rushed to remove all traces of Anne Boleyn's initials and badges and replace them with Jane's family emblem of a phoenix and her heraldic beast, a panther. The motto she had chosen was "Bound to obey and serve," and as queen, Jane continued to be anything but Anne Boleyn. Demure and subservient, she never disobeyed or even disagreed with Henry. She refused to discuss religion or politics. Perhaps because she was only a knight's daughter, she seemed insecure about her status and insisted on strict protocol and etiquette, remaining aloof from her ladies-in-waiting and earning a reputation as proud and haughty. She had a household of 200 ladies, officers, and servants, many of them transferred from service to Anne, and Jane enforced strict rules for their dress and moral behaviour. The king decked her in jewels and splendid dresses, but Jane relished simple pleasures. She was a fine seamstress and liked needlework. She loved her white poodle and her gardens. She enjoyed field sports and the hunt. Her first summer with Henry was a time of parties, pageants, hunting trips, and entertainments. At a banquet and tournament celebrating the triple wedding of the Earl of Westmoreland's three children, Henry appeared in disguise as the Sultan of Turkey. Jane was gracious to both of Henry's daughters. She persuaded the king to allow Mary's return to court, but only after Mary acknowledged that her mother's marriage had been incestuous and unlawful. Mary never forgave herself for that betrayal, but it made the king both generous and affectionate. Elizabeth, still a little girl, also visited the court occasionally, but spent most of her time in various palaces in the Thames Valley. Henry was planning an elaborate coronation and banquet for Jane in October, but when plague broke out in London, the ceremony was postponed indefinitely, and the court moved to Windsor to be out of danger. When Mary returned to court, Jane treated her as an equal, walking hand in hand and refusing to go first through a doorway. A bitter winter subdued the plague, and the court returned to London, where Jane announced in February that she was pregnant, and her coronation was postponed again to spare her any stress that might endanger the child. With the return of warm weather, the king meant to go hunting, but was prevented by a malady in his legs. Modern doctors think it might have been a recurrence of the abscess that he first suffered in 1536, or possibly osteomyelitis, a septic bone infection following an injury. Whatever the cause, he had unbearable pain in both legs. Forced inactivity speeded up his weight gain and made him even more irascible. After many ineffectual remedies, he recovered at least partially and took Jane on a pilgrimage through Kent, visiting Rochester, Sittingbourne, and Canterbury before returning to Hampton Court. Jane's pregnancy was going well, but plague broke out again in June, and the court went back to Windsor, where the fearful queen worried everyone by her hours of praying and overly dutiful fasting on holy days. With the plague killing more than 100 Londoners every week, the king forbade anyone from the city to approach the court. After a long, hard labour, Jane gave birth to a healthy boy on October 12, 1537. Henry had his heir at last. 2,000 guns sounded from the tower as the country celebrated. The king wept with joy as he held his son. Bonfires were lit, church bells rang, and free wine was handed out in London. The baby, 3 days old, was christened in the new Chapel Royal at Hampton Court after a magnificent torch-lit procession of the entire court and Privy Council. Some 400 dignitaries, even after the number was restricted for fear of the plague. The prince was named Edward, after his supposed ancestor, St. Edward the Confessor, last of the Anglo-Saxon kings. After the festivities, the procession carried him back to his mother's chamber, where the king and queen feasted with their guests until dawn. But that was the end of the celebrations. Probably because of the woeful hygiene of the times, Jane came down with puerperal fever. She was swathed in furs and coddled with rich food, but nothing could stop her decline, and on October 24th she died. The king shut himself away to mourn in private, and the court began 3 weeks of solemn obsequies. Jane's body lay for a week in her chamber, dressed in gold with a crown on her head and rings on her fingers, with her ladies keeping perpetual vigil on their knees around the bier. Meanwhile, dirges were sung and masses offered for the Queen's soul. Then the body was embalmed and moved in a coffin to the Chapel Royal, where priests watched over it by night, and the ladies, with Mary Tudor as chief mourner, kept vigil by day. The funeral was another magnificent occasion, with a wax effigy of the Queen complete with a crown, carried atop the bier in solemn procession to Windsor, where she was buried in a vault in the choir of St. George's Chapel. 12,000 masses were said in London churches, and the king planned to raise a splendid tomb in Jane's honour. However, it was never built. The court was in formal mourning for the next 3 months, but soon after the funeral Henry reappeared and was said to be in good health and merry as a widower may be. Already he was talking about taking another wife. Thomas Cromwell had begun laying plans for a more politically advantageous marriage for his king. A number of prospective brides were considered and rejected. In December 1538, the Pope finally excommunicated Henry. A month later, Charles V and Francis I formed yet another alliance. Henry, who at one time had been allied with both monarchs, was more alone than ever. With Protestantism spreading throughout England and Europe, Cromwell thought it wise for Henry to marry a Protestant from the continent, and by the spring of 1539 he'd found a willing candidate. Her name, unfortunately, was Anne. She was 23 years old, the daughter of a prominent duke, and lived in the Duchy of Cleves in Germany. Cromwell assured the king that she was a lovely girl. Henry, now three times disappointed in marriage, commissioned painter Hans Holbein to travel to Cleves and make a portrait of the prospective next Queen of England. In case Henry should be dissatisfied with the result, Holbein was told to paint Anne's sister, Amalia, too. Ambassador Nicholas Wotton, who went along on the trip to assess the sisters' personalities, told the king that Anne was a quiet woman of 24, poorly educated, who couldn't sing or play any musical instrument, and who spoke no other language but her native German. She was clearly dull and untalented, certainly no match for the cultivated king. But Wotton added that he thought Holbein's portrait had captured Anne well, and Henry, who liked the portrait, consented to marry her. As it turned out, the portrait was exceedingly flattering. On January 1, 1540, when her ship docked at Rochester, tradition has it that Henry spied on her in her chamber to get a glimpse before his official meeting. If he did, or if he waited, he didn't like what he saw. "She is nothing so fair as she hath been reported," he complained to Cromwell. "I like her not." Could the marriage be called off? Not, Cromwell said, without causing a major diplomatic incident. So on January 6, 1540, Henry married Anne of Cleves. But after the wedding night, the king told Cromwell that he had been so put off by the hanging of her breasts and the looseness of her flesh that he could not consummate the marriage. Anne's ladies later confirmed this account, saying Anne had told them that nothing had happened beyond a couple of kisses. Henry and Anne lived together for 6 months, but he was clearly out of sorts. On the one hand, he insisted that the marriage hadn't been consummated. Preposterously, he also hinted darkly that she wasn't a virgin. Again, the court began talking of annulment. Soon the courtiers whispered that Anne in her childhood had been briefly betrothed to another man, and thus wasn't eligible to marry Henry. In June, the king ordered her to leave the court, and she went willingly, even agreeing to write a letter confirming the non-consummation. A month later, the marriage was officially annulled. It had lasted just 7 months. Henry may have felt guilty about his treatment of Anne. In any case, he made a generous settlement, giving her properties including Richmond Palace and Hever Castle, the former seat of the Boleyn family. To everyone's surprise, Anne and the king became good friends. She was often at court, a good-natured, generous woman who was called the king's beloved sister, and who mothered his daughters Mary and Elizabeth. Anne spent the rest of her life in England, outliving Henry, and was the only one of his wives to be buried in Westminster Abbey. The English people were not troubled by Henry's brief marriage to a Protestant. By 1540, the English church was neither Catholic nor Protestant, but a kind of hybrid. Most of the Catholic monasteries in England were closed. Functionally, the Church of England still resembled the Catholic Church. Henry had been reluctant to give up the traditional rituals of Roman Catholicism, but Lutheranism was spreading across the country. England was by no means subsumed by the Reformation, but it was facing change. Thomas Cromwell was facing worse. He had become the latest target of the king's temper. Henry was already annoyed with his chief adviser over his mismatched marriage to Anne of Cleves, and Cromwell's enemies seized that moment to whisper to the king that Cromwell had been offering protection to Protestant heretics and may have been looking for a way to marry Henry's daughter Mary. None of this made sense. Mary was a devout Catholic who would never have agreed to marry a reformer like Cromwell. But Henry also knew that Cromwell had a low opinion of the next bride he was eyeing, Catherine Howard. Worse, much worse for Cromwell, the king accused him of talking to Anne of Cleves about Henry's impotence. Cromwell was arrested at a meeting of the Privy Council that same month and taken to the Tower. Henry dispensed with the formality of a trial and simply ordered Cromwell's execution. Cromwell was beheaded on July 28, 1540, as Henry and Catherine exchanged their vows. His head was set on a pike on London Bridge. Chapter 10. An Old Man's Travails. Henry was a king who could not stay unmarried. He was hardly a fit bridegroom. Ill-tempered, occasionally impotent, and susceptible to gout, leg ulcers, and boils, Henry VIII was no longer the prince whose face and physique had once made him the most attractive monarch in the world. His weight had ballooned to 300 pounds. His armourers reported that his waist now measured 54 inches. Now he was just the king. But that was enough. He could still have his pick of the court's women. The bold and pretty Catherine Howard was a first cousin of Anne Boleyn, and had been a lady-in-waiting to Anne of Cleves. She was just 17 years old, and a newcomer to court. Though no innocent, she was a naive in the intrigues and pitfalls of court life, and whether or not she realised it, she was to become the pawn of a powerful court faction. But Catherine was childishly delighted when she caught the eye of the king early in his non-marriage to the queen she was serving. Their courtship followed Henry's usual pattern. The king flirted with her and gave her expensive gifts.
And so, just 19 days after his marriage to Anne of Cleves was annulled, Henry married Catherine Howard at Oatlands, the palace on the Thames near Surrey that Henry had remodelled in anticipation of his marriage to Anne of Cleves.
It was a quiet ceremony with none of the rituals of most royal occasions, and Henry didn't crown Catherine as queen. He may have been waiting for her to become pregnant, even though he already had an heir in Prince Edward. But he catered to her whims and showered her with jewels and gifts. Besotted with her youth and vivacious charm, he seemed convinced of her blameless character and called her his rose without a thorn. In that, he was seriously misled. The daughter of a relatively poor younger son, Catherine had been brought up along with other penniless aristocrats in the London household of her grandmother, Agnes Howard, the Dowager Duchess of Norfolk. The old lady was away most of the time, leaving her young charges mostly unsupervised to behave as they chose. By the time she was 13, Catherine had begun sexual relations with her music teacher, Henry Mannox, then had a long-term affair with the Duchess's secretary, Francis Dereham. It was intense. They called each other husband and wife and planned to marry. But when the affair became obvious, Catherine was removed from the Duchess's household, and an uncle found her a place among the ladies serving Anne of Cleves. With such a history, it was hugely risky for Catherine to think of marrying the king. But at 17, she undoubtedly felt invulnerable. Henry and Catherine seemed happy, and the members of the court waited eagerly for Catherine to become pregnant. But she was reckless. In the spring of 1541, just a few months into her marriage, Catherine began an affair with one of Henry's advisers, Thomas Culpeper, an ambitious young man who was already a member of the Privy Council. Incredibly, their secret meetings had been arranged by one of Catherine's ladies-in-waiting, Jane Boleyn, the widow of Anne Boleyn's brother, George. Catherine had been careless in her assignations with Culpeper, and word of their relationship spread throughout the court. Before long, Catherine was threatened with blackmail. Impulsively, she appointed Dereham as her personal secretary, hoping he might tamp down the growing scandal. In the summer of 1541, Henry took Catherine with him on a tour of northern England, with both Culpeper and Dereham in the entourage. The rumour was that Catherine was pregnant and would be crowned after the announcement was made. The king was still obviously besotted with her. But after their return to London, a servant in the Dowager Duchess's household told her brother about Catherine's affair with Dereham. The brother wrote Archbishop Cranmer, who told the king. When Henry dismissed the matter, Cranmer backed it up by showing him a love letter from Catherine to Culpeper. Recognising her handwriting, Henry wept. Both Culpeper and Dereham were arrested, but but it was only in early November, when Catherine herself was interrogated by Cranmer, that she realized she'd been caught. Cranmer reported, "I found her in such lamentation and heaviness as I never saw no creature, so that it would have pitied any man's heart to have looked upon her." She was so distressed that he ordered the royal guards to remove objects from her chamber to prevent her from harming herself. Cranmer urged the king to have the marriage annulled on the basis of Catherine's pre-marriage contract with Dereham, and sent her into exile rather than behead her. But Henry insisted on a trial. Later that month, Catherine was stripped of her title and imprisoned in an abbey in Middlesex. Under torture, both Dereham and Culpeper confessed their crimes. When the king was told, he flew into a rage and threatened to kill Catherine with his own hands. Thomas Culpeper was beheaded. Francis Dereham was hanged, drawn, and quartered. Their heads were displayed on pikes on London Bridge. In early February 1542, with Catherine still in prison, Parliament charged her with treason under a year-old law that made it a crime, punishable by death, for a queen consort to conceal her sexual history from the king. In a familiar tableau, a distraught Catherine Howard was hauled to the Tower of London days later. On February 13, 1542, under grey skies, Catherine was led to the scaffold on the Tower Green at 7 a.m. The day before her execution, composing herself for the ordeal, she had asked that the block be brought to her cell so she could practice placing her neck on it. Catherine's head came off with a single stroke. So did Jane Boleyn's, who put her neck on the block while it was still wet with Catherine's blood. With that, Henry VIII's fifth marriage was over. This time, there was no bride in waiting. In any case, Henry was preoccupied by a series of foreign adventures. On the continent, the alliance between Charles V and Francis I had soured into war, and Henry signed a secret new alliance with Charles, calling for him to join Spain in invading France. At the same time, he was being plagued closer to home by the ever-unruly Scots, stubbornly clinging to Catholicism under the young King James V. Henry decided to quash the threat and extend the Reformation with an invasion, and defeated James at the Battle of Solway Moss in November 1542. After James died a month later, his regent agreed to a future marriage between Henry's son Edward and James's daughter Mary, who had become Scotland's Queen Regnant when she was only 6 days old. In the future, she would be known as Mary, Queen of Scots. In July 1543, Henry VIII married a sixth and final time. His new wife, a distant cousin, was a wealthy widow named Catherine Parr. Perhaps the king was finally acting his age, giving up the quest for beautiful young virgins and political alliances. This time, his bride would be a mature, capable woman, with a level head on her shoulders and an intellect matching his own. Catherine Parr was well-educated, fluent in several languages, and enjoyed debating religion and politics with the king. Henry still clung to the somewhat confused combination of Catholicism and Protestantism he had launched, and she was a dedicated member of his Reformed Church of England. Raised by a widowed mother who took pains with her schooling, Catherine had developed a lifelong love of learning and a sense that an independent woman could make a meaningful life for herself. At 31, Catherine had survived two marriages. Her first husband died after only a few years, leaving her childless. Her second, John Neville, Baron Latimer, succumbed to a long illness during which she cared for him and his two children with kindness and affection. Then she joined the household of Henry's daughter Mary, where she was being courted by the dashing Thomas Seymour, brother of the late Queen, when the King himself stepped in and offered his hand. Catherine had been set to marry Seymour, but she had been raised to royal service and accepted Henry. Thomas Seymour was sent to Brussels on a diplomatic mission, and Henry and Catherine were married at Hampton Court on July 12, 1543. From the start, Queen Catherine set out to make the king's life as pleasant as possible. Sharing his love of poetry, music, dancing, and intellectual debate, she was an excellent companion for the aging Henry. She restored a sense of gaiety at court, but with none of the extravagance and feverish intrigue that Anne Boleyn had nurtured. Catherine made sure there were jesters and entertainers to soothe the king's temper, and she used her skills as foster mother to sweeten his relations with his daughters. Anne of Cleves had begun this process of reconciliation, but Catherine Parr carried it much further. She made no effort to mother Lady Mary, who was nearly her own age, but won her affection by treating her like a princess, and she hired some of Europe's best scholars to educate both Edward and Elizabeth. Finally, Elizabeth had a mother figure who was both affectionate and could appreciate the girl's sharp intellect. Catherine also worked on Henry on behalf of her stepdaughters, and in 1544 Parliament passed a new Act of Succession, ending their bastardization and restoring them both to a distant right to the throne. Poised, cheerful, and shrewd, Catherine was immediately popular with the court, and when Henry went off to France for his last military adventure, he left Catherine as regent to run the country in his absence, a task she performed adroitly. To the annoyance of the Emperor, Charles, Henry had dragged his feet in the promised invasion of France, but in June of 1544 he finally launched a two-pronged attack on Boulogne and Montreuil. With Henry in personal command, Boulogne fell to the English in September. But the Emperor's attack from the south made little headway. Charles urged Henry to attack Paris, but Henry hesitated again. He was still preparing to march when Charles surrendered to Francis, leaving Henry alone to battle the French. Besides being poorly planned and executed, the war had been disastrously expensive. Henry took his army back to a nearly bankrupt England, with only a distant prospect of relief. In the treaty that finally followed, the English got to keep Boulogne for 8 years, receiving 2 million crowns, 750,000 English pounds, when they handed it back. In England, the religious wars were flaring up again. Ever since Henry's break with Rome, a strong Catholic faction had resisted the new English church, and the fall of the Protestant reformer Cromwell had strengthened these conservatives. But the equally ardent Protestants were using their access to the English language scriptures to argue with their priests and criticise clerical behaviour. The king tried to walk a middle line, warning Parliament not to rail on bishops, speak slanderously of priests, and rebuke and taunt preachers, and be not judges yourselves of your own fantastical opinions and vain expositions, for in such high causes you may lightly err. Be in charity one with another. But even Henry's regal power was hemmed in by political reality. The conservative faction was able to prosecute more radical Protestants as heretics, and in one case, that of the preacher Anne Askew, who was tortured and burned at the stake, the Catholics tried to link Queen Catherine to the heresy. Henry had to consent to a warrant for her arrest, which came to nothing when she argued successfully that her theological discussions were meant to distract him from the pain of his ulcerous leg. But it was a reminder to the king to proceed cautiously. Querulous and increasingly paranoid, the king reacted to any hint of treasonous behaviour in the Tudor court, and the Catholic faction provided ammunition. In the fall of 1546, Henry focused his attention on one of his oldest and most trusted advisers, Thomas Howard, the Duke of Norfolk. Norfolk and his son, the Earl of Surrey, were rumoured to be in favour of restoring the Catholic Church in England and reasserting the supremacy of the Pope. Their enemies also claimed that they were waiting for Henry to die so that they could punish England's Protestant reformers. Both were taken to the Tower. Surrey was tried and convicted of treason. He was beheaded on January 19, 1547. His was the last head to roll under the rule of Henry VIII. Norfolk was still awaiting his trial when Henry fell ill, and escaped beheading when the king died. But his lands were seized, and he wasn't released from the Tower for another 6 years. The king's decline and death were long and painful. In the 38th year of his reign, he was so bloated that he had to be carried from room to room on a specially designed chair. Queen Catherine moved from her royal apartments to an anteroom next to his bedroom so that she could help if he fell ill in the night. But tender nursing couldn't ease the king, who raged about imagined plots and intrigues at court and fretted over the succession. His son Edward was healthy and promised to be a successful king, but he was still only 9 years old and couldn't rule on his own for several years, during which he might be overthrown. Restlessly, Henry moved from one palace to another, trying various remedies and medicinal baths, while London buzzed with rumours about his failing health. In December of 1546, a fever almost killed the king. People who saw him said he was ashen, sick, and weak. In his cell in the Tower, the hopeful Norfolk told friends that Henry could not endure long. But he rallied and weathered the long journey from his palace at Oatlands to London, taking it in short stages. On Christmas Eve, at the king's orders, Catherine took his daughters to mark the festive day at Greenwich, leaving him in seclusion at Whitehall. Another fever in January sparked rumours that he was dead, but he survived and then endured the agonising cauterization of his ulcerated leg. Amazingly, Henry rallied again. He ordered French saplings for his garden and on January 17th gave an audience to the French and Spanish ambassadors. They had been warned not to tire him, but they were astonished at his good spirits and lucidity as he apologised for the delay his health had caused and discussed international problems, military developments, and the closer amity he sought with France. 2 days later, the king was planning a ceremony to invest his son as Prince of Wales. But that was Henry's last hurrah. He relapsed next day and sank steadily. On January 25th, he called the Queen to his bedside. "It is God's will that we should part," he began, but then choked up. Weeping, he waved her away. By the evening of January 27th, he was failing fast, and the council, knowing he was near death, ordered all English ports closed. In the early hours of January 28, 1547, nobody had warned Henry that he seemed about to die. It was treason to predict the king's death. But one of Henry's bolder advisers, Sir Anthony Denny, approached the king's bed and warned him that, in man's judgment, he was not like to live, and asked what holy man should be called. The king said it would be Archbishop Cranmer, "But I will first take a little sleep, and then, as I feel myself, I will advise upon the matter." Cranmer was summoned, but by the time he arrived, Henry could no longer speak. When the prelate asked him to give a sign that he died in the favour of Christ, the king did wring his hand as hard as he could, and soon after that he was gone. There was lamentation in Parliament when the king's death was announced, but on January 31st, when young Edward was brought to the Tower and named king, the heralds gave the traditional cry, "The king is dead! Long live the king!" Edward would be king for just 6 years, dying in 1553, probably of tuberculosis. Succeeding him as Bloody Mary, his older half-sister would try to return England to Catholicism until her death in an influenza epidemic in 1558. Then his other half-sister would lead the country into the grandeur of the Elizabethan age. But now church bells were tolling and dirges were sounding all over England. In Paris, Henry's old foe Francis I, himself dying of syphilis, ordered a requiem mass at Notre Dame. Henry's body, embalmed and encased in lead, was taken in solemn procession from Whitehall to Windsor. Atop the vast coffin was a wax effigy of the king, dressed in crimson velvet and wearing a crown, bedecked with jewelled bracelets and rings over velvet gloves. In the black-draped chapel of St. George at Windsor Palace, 16 strong yeomen of the guard lowered Henry's casket into the vault next to the coffin of Jane Seymour, while Queen Catherine watched from the private chamber known as Catherine of Aragon's closet. At the end of the ceremony, the chief officers of the royal household signalled the end of their service by breaking their white staves of office and dropping them into the vault beside the coffins. The tumultuous, bloody, transformative reign of Henry VIII of England was over. This concludes the reading of Henry VIII by Abigail Archer. Copyright 2015 by Abigail Archer. This book was read by Sarah Nichols. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with New Word City, care of Grosvenor Literary Agency, and was produced in 2017 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.